Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Fink, and it's Monday, May 10th, and this is the Chris Degania forum call. This is an open forum. If we get callers, we'll have a forum. If we don't get callers, well, I don't know what to say. How you doing, MacDoc?
Yes, I'm Dale.
How's everything? All right. How's everything?
Not too bad.
Good.
Oh, warm, but not too humid, luckily. So, but hey, I was reading at the Sun Herald, the local paper today, and sure enough, they got a story about some witnesses tell stories of survival, and I kind of thought it was a little bit interesting because it talks about people witnessing and hearing a couple of explosions on board, and I don't know if the regular media is going to try to whitewash this whole witness thing. Maybe a few months from now you won't even hear from them or whatever, but
That were on the oil rig, I assume.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. It's
okay.
A couple of them. If you want, I could try to read the first couple paragraphs of the article.
Yeah, go ahead. Let us know what's up.
Okay. Here we go. Sun Herald from today says, witnesses tell stories of survival. Venice, Louisiana. Oleander Benton was chatting with a friend in the laundry when the lights went out. The other woman had just gotten up to find a maintenance person when the deep-sea oil rig struck with an ear-shattering bang, followed by a long Benton's safety training kicked in. The cook hit the floor as ceiling tiles and light fixtures came crashing down on her head and back. The concussion had blown a door off its hinges and pinned her friend to the floor. My leg, the woman screamed. Benton rose to her feet and stepped over the debris, but she couldn't move to the door. She told her friends to lie flat and slide herself out, and the two made their way into the darkened hallway, where a man in a white T-shirt appeared out of the swirling dust and beckoned. Come on, Miss O, he shouted. Go this way. This is a real deal. This is a real deal. After a nightmare journey through halls illuminated only by exit signs and clogged with dazed and injured people, Benton emerged onto the deck of the Deepwater Horizon. Fire and mud were spewing from the rig's shattered 242-foot derrick. People with ghastly head wounds were scrambling about. Many had been asleep when the blast occurred and wandered the slick, debris-strewn deck shoeless, clad in little more than their orange life jackets. Their bare skin speckled with bits of white insulation from blown-out walls. Benton slipped and stumbled as she headed for her assigned lifeboat. As a worker checked off names, Benton was transported back 5 years to Hurricane Katrina. She had spent five hellish days in the swelter of the Louisiana Superdome. That was the last time she had felt this kind of heat, this kind of terror. It was April 20th, Benton's 52nd birthday. With its complement of 126 riggers, contractors, and... turn the page here... and support personnel, the Deepwater Horizon, floating 48 miles out in the Gulf of Mexico, had a population larger than that of at least a half a dozen Louisiana towns. It was a long article. I could finish the rest of it. It goes into, but that was basically the witnesses' accounts of some of the explosions. I think there might be a couple more in here if you want me to go on, but it's up to you.
Well, now I'm trying to absorb and ponder how a pressure break deep in the ocean could cause that kind of explosion and that kind of
exactly that kind
of havoc on the deck. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I know it doesn't. I mean, unless you had a natural gas pocket, but that I don't even think that kind of a boom would
If the pipe indeed broke first deep under the sea, how could it get, you know, I mean, the pressure would be released there.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I wouldn't think you'd have that kind of pressure coming up to the hole, you know?
No, I couldn't imagine it. I can't imagine it.
I mean, even my dad, I mean, he's a geologist, he worked in the oil and natural gas field as a geologist and stuff, and worked on many onshore rigs, and he's not a conspiracy guy at all, and he still thinks, you know, Muslims did 9/11 and this and that. And even he's saying, you know, this is probably bombs playing somewhere. So,
Well, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that jumps on every conspiracy, because I think that they all have to be examined, because there's a lot of disinformation out there.
Oh, yeah.
I got a letter from this whack job a couple of weeks ago telling me that there was no volcano in Iceland. actually, it came out of a place. Now this place is the Rumor Mill News, right? It's kind of a tree hugger operation, but they've been around. I remember subscribing to the Rumor Mill News in 1995. I subscribed to their mailing list. That's how long they've been around. Now the Rumor Mill News, I got an email. Some quack, this she stopped by here before. I won't mention her name. She had about six different handles. She doesn't like me. She's some nut job feminist from Southern California. And even though she doesn't like me, she keeps me on her trash mailing list. She sent me this email that from the Rumor Mill News that there was no volcano in Iceland, that it was all holographs on television.
Oh, sure.
Everything's that's just a holograph. Incredible. Well, right, and the soot and the ash over Britain, that's a holograph too. Basically, that's an example of how crazy. I mean, well, we had natural disasters for 5,000 years in recorded history before we ever heard a harp, right? The Roman Caesars didn't have their own harp machines to create earthquakes in Greece. It didn't happen. That's why I'm dubious, and I like to weigh out conspiracies before I jump on them. But those eyewitness descriptions, they don't seem to me to if there's too much pressure from oil rising through a pipe and it bursts deep in the sea, it's not going to cause that kind of havoc on the deck. I'm sorry. It's the pressures released into the water. Long before it could possibly travel up any pipe into the oil rig. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, like I said, even my dad's saying it's got to be an explosion. He said, stuff like that just don't happen. I mean, he knows. He's actually one of the geologists my dad works with. Is actually one of the. He told me he was one of the geologists that originally helped explore and kind of develop that field that rig was in. He used to work for BP and stuff, and he's like, that kind of thing never happens,
I couldn't imagine getting the truth from BP. They're gonna spin it to the best of their ability, but. I've seen two or three different conspiracy theories floating around the internet, and the most prevalent one that seems to be persuading people right now is that it's all Goldman Sachs sold the Gulf short and a day ahead of time and caused the explosion and this and that and Dick Cheney, and he's under investigation for it, so I don't know. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going around. You don't know what to believe, I mean, it's the Iceland volcano people all over again. I don't know. It's I like to examine everything and not feel that I have to enlist myself into any particular side or any particular belief until the facts come out.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, there's people saying,
except 9/11. I knew from the minute I saw Building 7 fall that was a frame up. As soon as I saw Building 7 fall, I knew it was something was fishy.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, back then, I was unaware of stuff like that. So I bought into all that crap until about a year, probably 2 years ago, and started listening to Jones and all that stuff. And then I knew Hippie Jabber and all that. But then, with those types of people like Jones and all that, they always focus on, how the buildings came down and this and that. They don't ever get to the real root of who did it. It's just
I see them all as halfway houses. Alex Jones is and Pete Peters, he's a religious halfway house. Alex Jones is a conspiratorial halfway house.
That's why we're gonna end up too.
There's a lot of halfway houses before you get to the truth. Yeah, we all have a long trek, right?
Exactly. Indeed.
None of us got here in a day or that, and none of us are going to get to where we're going in a day either, so that's the way it is.
Definitely not. Rome wasn't built in a day.
No.
A couple days.
Well, if somebody else, Richtar, why don't you call in and talk about that book? I need some fodder for this program. We have to have some conversation, right? That's what a forum is.
Bailey found me to waste some more time. I could read the rest of the article.
Well, you're not wasting time. I mean, it's time well spent. But, this program's about what the listeners make it.
Well, just give me a go ahead. I'll read the rest of it. Let me go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. I'd actually like to hear the other accounts.
Okay, here we go. April 20th was a big day for BP, PLC, and the rig's inhabitants. The day before, contractors from Halliburton Energy Services, Incorporated, had finished cementing the well's pipes nearly 5,000 feet below the water surface. Workers were busy setting a second seal at the wellhead, one of the last steps before the rig could move off, and the exploration well could make the transition to a production well. BP executives were on board to celebrate that milestone and another achievement. Deepwater Horizon was the first rig to go 7 years without a lost time accident. They were gathered in the living quarters just below the working deck when the enormous bubble of explosive methane gas erupted from the seafloor and rocketed up the drill pipe's 21-inch metal sheath toward the surface, if that's what really happened. It was around 10 p.m. Train operator Micah Sandell, 40, of Leesville, Louisiana, was in the cab 30 feet off the deck when he saw the water and mud shoot up out of the derrick. He knew immediately it was a blowout, and he got on the radio to tell the crew to move to the front of the rig. Then something exploded. Sandell was knocked to the floor, and fire engulfed the cabin. Certainly he was about to die. The devout Baptist clapped his hands over his head and cried, "Oh God, no." But after a few seconds, he stood up and realized the fireball had passed over him. He made it halfway down the stairs before another blast occurred, throwing him 15 feet to the steel deck. He got up again and ran, feeling his way rail around the port side toward the lifeboats. Hanging off the side of the rig and covered, the boats could hold up to 50 people each. Crew members with clipboards called out names as people clambered aboard. Some couldn't wait any longer and jumped. It was 80 feet to the water. A person falling from that height would take about 2.25 seconds to hit the water and experience about 20 Gs, roughly the same force as a car hitting a brick wall at 55 miles an hour. In Port Fuchon Harbor, the service vessel Joe Griffin was tied up at the Halliburton slip. Captain Nate Foster was standing on the bridge shortly before 11 p.m. when the radio crackled to life. We need you to get out there as fast as you can, the dispatcher barked. We have people in the water. The orange-hulled vessel is primarily a supply ship, and much of its 280-foot length is open deck space. But the Joe Griffin is also equipped with two water cannons, each capable of shooting 5,000 gallons of water per minute. Foster picked up the ship's phone and called the engine room. I want the engine started, the 37-year-old Montanan told the oiler. We need them now. Don't let them warm up. As the vessel entered open water, Foster opened the throttle all the way to 12 knots. At that speed, it would take 9.5 hours to reach the deep water horizon. A 260-foot Damon B. Bankston, a black-hulled cargo vessel, was tethered to the deep water horizon. That day, it had been pumping drilling mud from the rig for use at the next job. The first explosion threw seaman Elton Johnson of Bunky, Louisiana, about 7 feet into an engine room door, knocking him unconscious. When he came to, he staggered to the deck and looked over the rail to see people floating in the water. Like the rest of the crew, Johnson began fishing out survivors. In the deep water horizon, deck pusher Bill Johnson, supervising operations on the deck, worked his way across the rig, acrid smoke burning his lungs. He ushered two members of his crew into a lifeboat and shoved off, but there was one man missing. Crane operator Aaron Dale Burkeen of Philadelphia, Mississippi, had relieved Sandell for dinner. The 37-year-old father of two had just recently received his 10-year certificate. April 20th was his and his wife Rhonda's 8th wedding anniversary. His birthday was 4 days away. When the first concussion hit, he began lowering his crane 150-foot boom into its cradle and locking it down. He got it to about a 30-degree angle when he decided to make a run for it. He was about halfway down the spiral staircase when a massive explosion occurred. Bill Johnson, who was not just Burkeen's directing supervisor, but also one of his best friends, watched helplessly from the rocking boat as the whole starboard side of the rig erupted in a cloud of smoke and flame. Burkeen just vanished. The Joe Griffin was still 35 miles out when the crew saw it, a glow on the horizon like a mini sunrise. 20 minutes out, Captain Foster ordered the crew to fire up the water cannon pumps. When the vessel arrived at the scene around 8:30 a.m., flames were shooting several hundred feet into the air, and oil was raining down on 24 or so boats trying to fight the fire and ferry survivors. Even though the glass window was with a protective shell for the bridge, First Mate Doug Pete could feel the inferno's heat on his skin. As he trained the cannon on the fire, he thought to himself, this is a lost cause. A little way off, Sandal stood on the Bankston's plank deck and watched the rig that had been his home for the past 8 years pitch and burn. He wanted desperately to call home and tell his wife and their three children that he was alive. There were satellite phones on board, but the workers were not allowed to use them. When Sandal arrived at Port Futrin early the next morning, he still hadn't slept. 11 rig workers were unaccounted for, including Aaron Dale Burkeen. Even as the Deepwater Horizon was in its last throes before sinking beneath the Gulf, speculation was already rampant about what had caused the explosion. Was it negligence, freak accident, foul play? Sandal and the others just wanted to go ashore and call loved ones. But there was one more thing to do next. As he debarked, he noticed some Coast Guard and Company officers sitting at a table, a row of portable toilets behind them. Before they left the docks, the workers would have to be drug tested. Tired and angry, Sandal stood in line and filled out forms. When his turn came, he took the plastic cup, stepped inside one of the outhouses, and closed the door behind him. That's the end of the article. That's how it ends. I mean, it sounded like, you know, it definitely had a lot of gas burning off. That's why it burned for a couple of days. But, you know, the real question, of course, is what caused the initial explosion, that rock thing, and slammed people into the wall, you know?
Right, and I don't know, multiple explosions to me don't jive.
Exactly.
And the fact that there are explosions at the surface doesn't really jive. If pressure had burst the equipment below the ocean level. Mm-hmm. If the equipment's burst below the ocean level, then the pressure can't be released at the surface. I don't know. I'm no engineer, but it doesn't add up to me.
Yeah. It seems like it. I mean, I don't know, it's just weird. I've just been keeping following it because I live down here and they get some of that oil and stuff like that. But
we actually have a listener. He's not here tonight unless he's hiding out as one of those guests. But we got a listener that worked on oil rigs. And
really?
He's from Louisiana. And there's another listener that works on gas wells down there. I mean, I know that's not oil rigs, but.
Oh, okay. Sure. Maybe
he
call
might
him.
Be listening tonight, but he won't call in. I can't even get him to come on with his name. Are you kidding? No. I'm pretty sure he's probably listening, but. He's always a guest, so I can't. Maybe we could find that online, and I could put it on a forum or something. Because I'd like to keep that just to see what they come out with in 3-4 months down the road.
Yeah, it'll all be covered. That's why I'm definitely, when I saw that, I was like, man, I definitely got to keep this because I know. Can use it to prove to somebody that it was whitewashed if they do whitewash it, like they do everything else. So,
yeah, well, I'm sure they will. So, what else is happening? I can't get anybody to call into this program tonight. I don't know. People must be getting tired of hearing me or something.
Hope not. I don't know. That's kind of weird. This is the first time I've been on this forum and just, you know, but one person calling in, you know. I mean,
the weather's getting nice and people are spending more time outside. It's white out later. You know, I mean, I just came from upstairs, 8 o'clock. It was still light out. It was nice. I would have liked to have been out myself, but I have to be here, but that's okay.
Hmm. Yeah. And see, a commander put on there again about Goldman Sachs shorting it. And I think, I have read a couple things about that, too. I think there is something about that, too, but I just,
Yeah, I've seen several articles on that. I don't, but yeah, you know, the Huffington Post is not a legitimate source of news to me. And a lot of people repeated that Huffington Post article, and I don't, yeah, you know, they're just absolutely, that's just straight propaganda. That's and this article the commander is on. Is linking to is you know, a quote from the Huffington Post. I'd like to hear from a more legitimate source than the Huffington Post.
I think that's not even the one I saw. I saw a couple of them, but I'll have to look into them. Let me click on that real quick. I don't know if I have the same one.
I don't doubt that Goldman Sachs is a crime ring. There's no doubt that there's a legitimate crime ring. A legal crime ring, because they get away with it. And they're legislated, but they're protected through legislation. But
exactly.
Yeah, that says I don't believe anything the Huffington Post says. I take with a grain of salt. She's another whore. She's another whore for the mainstream, for the Jews, the tree huggers, whoever will give her some money. How you doing, Greg?
Good, Bill. How are you?
All right. All I got to say, Greg, is, yeah, you know, I'm really, your situation is really unfortunate, and there are a lot of men in a situation like that, but I also know a few women in that same situation.
Yeah.
That I think it's just a bunch of mismatches. I don't know what to say.
Well, you know, there's various levels of adversarial communication, and mine was getting to a point where, you know, we just had to separate for a while just to let the smoke clear from the room and see what we've got. But it just crossed a line here a while back when I was told that what I believed was of a satanic nature. And I had a sense within me when that was told to me that was my ground to separate. You know, I know certain brothers that their wives don't see all the, you know, the men see, but that they're okay to stay under the leadership of the man, and even if they don't see eye to eye, it doesn't become adversarial. But mine did, and I just felt that it was time for us to go our separate ways for a while, and we'll see how it plays out.
Well, thanks, MacDog. Thanks for reading that, and thanks for calling in. I appreciate it, and I'm sure everybody does. RP's asking me, Greg, how many times I've been divorced. I got to admit that I've only been divorced once. But that's because I was only married once. I was a real sinner when I was young. I admit it. And I had three long-term cohabitation periods with different women. Let me put it that way. And I was only married for one of them, and there were children produced in two of them. So, I mean, if I'd have got married three times, I'd have probably been divorced three times.
Well, you know, it's women are – And I'm generalizing a little bit, and I apologize to any women I offend, but women seem to not see clearly the truth of the races nearly as well as men see it. And that's a historical fact, and that's the way it was in the garden. Eve was the one that was deceived, not Adam. And it seems like that same naivete continues to this day. You know, women love to... They're suckers, in a sense, for other races.
Well, you know, my third wife was kind of like that. I'm calling her my third wife, right? And she didn't – I didn't leave her. I went to prison, and she basically abandoned me there. You know, she fit the description that you're giving. But my first two, you know, mates were they were both wonderful with that, and they always deferred to me on racial issues. And my wife, the one girl I married that I have three children with, she was always fairly racially conscious, even though ashamedly some of her sisters weren't.
Yeah.
But she was always fairly conscious.
Well, there's so much disinformation in the world on race, it's no surprise that, you know, so few people see it clearly.
Well, the Jewish propaganda machine is beating multiculturalism and diversity down into our heads every single day.
Oh,
every
absolutely.
Single television program, every single magazine, constantly. They are laying a real guilt trip on people who can discern a clear difference between races and cultures, who have the ability to evaluate certain peoples and the cultures they produce and discern that some cultures are better than others. Not all cultures are created equal.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I was on Eli's show Sunday, and we were discussing that very concept of the continual teaching of multiculturalism and celebrating diversity and that whole concept. And we came to the conclusion that absolutely is a doctrine of demons that Paul talked about in 1 Timothy chapter 4, that in the latter times there'd be seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. And, I mean, you look at what the fallen angels did when they first came to Earth. The very first thing they did was race mixing. That was the first thing that they did. They came down and had sex with the human women. And they promoted a multicultural atmosphere. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And this whole concept that, oh, we're just one big happy human family. All the races are the same. Race really isn't important. That's a lie straight out of hell. Race is everything.
Well, right. Race is everything. And you know, I got a questionnaire, and it seemed like an ADL setup to me. I got a questionnaire in the mail a few weeks ago at info@christogenia.org. And it was somebody pretending to be a student that wanted some questions for a term paper. And I read this question, and I said, you know, I'm going to read this, and I'm going to be a little slick about it. And basically they were asking me questions about race and crime. And they were asking me what kind of laws I would promote to stop crime, right, which is absolutely ridiculous. And they were asking me how laws and crime, you know, how law affects crime and this and that. And I basically replied that I wouldn't reply to each question individually. Yeah. I replied that laws don't stop crime. If laws stopped crime, we would have empty prisons in this country because we've got more freaking laws than any nation ever had in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
We would have empty prisons if laws stopped crime. But we have more prisoners than any civilization in the history of the world.
Yeah.
We have over 2 million people in prison. And we have more laws than anybody. Laws evidently don't stop crime. Culture stops crime. And where Christian European culture predominates, crime rates are negligible.
Right.
Culture stops crime. Laws don't stop crime. And if you don't have that culture, well, then you're going to commit crime.
Yeah, and it's obvious that our lawlessness in our nation is a direct result of us being flooded by the dark races, because they're the one doing the vast majority of the crime.
And wherever you bring the Africans, what do you end up with?
Crime.
You end up with Africa. That's what you end up with.
Yeah,
and
lawlessness.
And wherever you bring the Hindus, you end up with India.
Yeah.
And that should be clearly that's clearly demonstrated. Just look at their neighborhoods.
Well, it's so obvious that the Jewish strategy is to just flood every single white nation with dark races.
At the same time that the Jews are yelling, we need more laws. But laws don't stop crime.
Yeah, they just really bring in more chaos. And the Jew is a
master. Laws oppress the law-abiding.
Yeah, and the Jew is a master of introducing chaos to organized white nations. And when chaos is reigning like it is now, the Jew is able to just work their evil magic and, you know, interject themselves into everything. And, you know, we've got a new Jew about to become a Supreme Court justice.
Man, she is disgusting. She looks like a straight Hittite. She fell off an old Assyrian stone.
she, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that Bertram Comparé was right on with his concept that the mark of Cain was the big hook nose, because you look at her face, that is the mark of Cain.
Well, I saw inscriptions of her that dated to 3000 BC. I swear, I saw them in an archaeology magazine. It said Hittite underneath it.
It has to be. The bloodline has clearly been preserved and passed along. Not that it's pure in any sense. You know, it's like a virus. It gets passed along from one generation to the other. You know, all it needs is to be passed along for it to survive. But yeah, that is one repulsive Jewess.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Bill.
I want to know why. Hello, Bruce. Praise Yahweh, and how are you?
Bruce.
Good.
I want to know why this is Obama's second Supreme Court nomination, and he has not nominated a black man or woman. Can't he throw a Negro a bone?
No.
Negroes can't get no respect even from the brothers.
Well, I had a conversation with somebody on this today. He did not choose, quote unquote, choose her. He clearly was told, this is who
well, of course,
Rahm
Emanuel made this list up. He has nothing to do with this.
Yeah, no black had a shot at getting on there.
No, we'll have like 4 or 5 Jews on the Supreme Court. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Breyer and Ginsburg, and Souter, I think, he's got to be a crypto Jew.
Got to be.
And then
he's off now, but
there's
he
that beach
one.
From Mexico. She's a Jewess. She's a Mexican Jew. And now
right.
this one. We'll, we'll have a majority of Jews on the Supreme Court. There's no doubt.
What could go wrong? You know, I know. It's a takeover. It's an absolute takeover. The world is so upside down. Very few people have the eyes to see it. We do, and it makes us crazy. We're the ones that are mourning, and soon we shall be comforted. You know, we're mourning over the fallen situation that we observe, and soon the comfort will come. I'm firmly convinced of it. And it's a hard time right now, though, you know.
MacDog wants to know, is it true that Janet Reno used to be a man? Yeah, you know, if I had to take a guess at it, I'd say that has to be true.
Wow, that's a strange-looking critter as well. I bet she had to have been Jewish, you know.
Hey, I kidnapped Abe Foxman's parrot. You want to hear him? Here. Say something. Barcuda, they saw my. Shut up. Oh, sorry.
I'm not sure what that was, but that was good.
So what's going on, Bruce?
just amazed about the paralysis going on in these Judeo-Christians. Nope.
Bill, I'll be right back.
Mike Delaney stood in front of a Lutheran church with a big sign, Jesus was not a Jew, and got a bunch of...
I
bunch
saw
of
that.
Those.
I can't wait till he shows us, till he puts up the video.
Yeah.
He sent me the still pictures. I can't wait. I would post them, but I don't want to put them out there like that. I'd like him to post them. But
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty good. Mike Delaney went and stood in front of a Lutheran church with a sign that said, "Jesus is not a Jew," and a copy of Luther's "The Jews and Their Lies." And he asked all the Lutherans if they know what their founder thought about the Jews. And all he got was cussed at. you could cuss Christ in this country, and you could cuss God, but don't you dare say anything bad about a Jew. Everything's upside down. There's no doubt.
Yeah. It's insane.
There's no doubt. Christians treat... The mainstream Christianity, or I should say mainstream churchianity, because it's not Christianity at all. Mainstream churchianity has deified the Jew. And mm-hmm. and the Jews, that's their religion. They're their own Messiah. That's the Talmud. They are their own Messiah. And mainstream churchianity has deified them. So they're in bed with them. They fully agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
So we only have... two religions in this country. We have Judaism for the circumcised and Judaism for the non-circumcised.
Well, I've regurgitated both of those.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Mike's in transit, John. He Skyped the pictures to me.
I was just eating dinner in a truck stop. Here in Nebraska, some old fellow was telling us, some other old fellow across the way, yeah, Eisenhower built the interstate system here. And I said, excuse me, that was Adolf's idea.
Eisenhower stole it from Adolf. You mean the Autobahn or the interstate system?
Well, yeah, they just put a new label on it, so get all the credit.
Well, you know, it's the interstate system was not built for the people. The interstate system was built for the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you know, the government doesn't care about the people. It's the corporations that want to move the freight back and forth across the country. That's why the interstates were built. To expedite economic growth for the Jews on Wall Street.
Yeah, the international mind.
We'd probably be a lot better off if people couldn't travel back and forth across the country so quickly.
Yeah.
Especially when they build that big super highway up out of Mexico.
Oh, they're actually going forward with that, huh?
The interstate system is basically a taxpayer burden that benefits corporations more than anything. That's the way the railroads were, too. I hope they shut it down, McBride. And yes, John, Mike does practice what he preaches. That's why he can't possibly be a troll. Trolls just sit behind their keyboards and never stick their necks out. They try to persuade everybody else to do that.
Yeah, it's like sitting in a foxhole with a weapon and shivering and shaking and butting your buddy in the head with it. Go out and do something.
Absolutely. Hey, pal, why don't you look up and see if they're still there? Well, while I got my server back together, I mean, it was down for a week. We blew it up trying to upgrade it last week, and we don't have shows on Friday and Saturday and Sunday. I can't do server work too, and Boxar's been helping me with it, and he's working now after a long hiatus, so he's not available as much as he was previously. But we got it together yesterday and today, and the server's repaired. The Wesley Swift site, which I had turned off for a week out of my own laziness, and then I switched it back to its old database. The Wesley Swift site is back up now. The search engine works on it. ChrisTagenia.net, there's not a whole lot there yet, but that's back up. And hopefully we'll be, by this time next week, we will be testing some sort of TalkShoe replacement software. If I have to call it that. I mean, I don't know if it's going to replace TalkShoe, but it's the capability will be there.
Hey, Bill, I'm back in the game. Hey, Bill, do you think this whole TalkShoe craziness is just TalkShoe messing up, or do you think that we're actually under some type of hacking attack because of what we're talking about?
Well, I don't know. I don't go to other programs. I don't have time for other TalkShoe programs, and I get mixed reports about TalkShoe's performance on other programs. Yeah, you know, some people tell me that this doesn't happen on other programs, and some people tell me it does. And yeah, you know, I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's not that either party is lying to me. They're just telling me their own experience.
Yeah.
You know, and TalkShoe, I went through a stage last week. Now, I use Firefox on a Linux box, all right, because Windows crashes all the time. I use, no matter what browser I use Firefox on Linux to get to TalkShoe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm sitting here looking at right now. And last week, it went through a rash of crashes where it was crashing every 5 minutes or hanging up or get, you know, when I couldn't stay on for longer than 5 minutes without it either hanging or crashing. And it was like that for a whole weekend, yet, you know, for one whole cycle of programs. And this week it's been good. This week it's hardly crashed. So I never know what to expect. I mean, it did not crash once for my programs on Saturday and Sunday.
It'd be great to have an alternative, you know. But I don't know. I just can't help but think, because of the message that we're proclaiming, that we're under some type of cyber attack by...
Well, right, but this alternative that we're looking at, it's going to be 100% controlled by me. I mean, and it's not... I'm not going to be at anybody's mercy over whether or not it's going to operate. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's on a server that I'm leasing that's with a foreign hosting company that... Yeah, you know, I have it's a pretty solid server. It's a pretty good company. It's a good connection. It's all mine. I have full control over it. If anything goes wrong, it's my fault. If it works, it's Boxar's credit, because he's helping me with it. It's open source software. It can't be screwed with. It's going to be pretty much locked down, and I won't be dependent on a third party, or at the mercy of a third party and their shoddy technology or their emotions or anything or their policies, and that there'll be nobody to complain to. There'll be nobody for the trolls to whine to, and that's the way it is.
Sounds good.
Thanks, McBragg. Forum postings help a lot. They help with search engines, and they help with trying to attract people to the site. Chris Figenia is getting, my main site's getting about 170 to 270 visits a day now, and it swings every week. It's hard to predict. It's 170 in midweek, and on the weekends, it's as high as 270, and some days more than that.
Whenever you see a hit from Rochester, do you automatically know it's me?
Well, no, I don't. I really don't pay attention that well, but you know, if I notice somebody on a little flag from Rochester, I'd probably assume it was you. There aren't too many Rochesters on my site.
I wish I could bump into, or that Yahweh would lead me into.
There's somebody from Erie, Pennsylvania right there now, though. I don't see that too often either.
Because I can't believe I'm the only one in this town that calls upon Yahweh and sees the truths that we see. There's got to be more here.
Well, the Northeast visits are few and far between.
Yeah.
Right now I got Erie, Pennsylvania, Des Moines, Iowa, and San Francisco, California up on the site. And I advertise on Craigslist. I run a few ads, and they're always getting deleted. They're always getting flagged, but I go run them again. And whenever one of my ads gets flagged, now I go find 10 Pinko ads and flag them all. Yeah, I'll find 10 left-wing ads or 10 moderate or mainstream Christian ads, and I'll flag them all. Every time one of my ads gets flagged, I'll go put an ad on the politics board in Vermont, say, and if somebody flags it, I go there and flag half the Pinko ads.
Well, it's obvious that Christian identity is never going to be popular, you know, but I've spent the last 2 years, Yahweh was providential that I lost my job in the pharmaceutical industry. After almost 20 years, that the last 2 years I've been able to devote pretty much all of my time to study of this belief. And I kid you not, this is the truest thing in the universe. There are no holes that can be poked in it. When you see the truth of the race and who the white race is, it's the most glorious thing to sink your teeth into that you're ever going to find. We are the elect of Yahweh in this world. I there is no doubt in my mind anymore. There really wasn't, even initially, but it took me a year of study to really, in my mind, be clear and study the history, and I got a lot of help from you and from Eli and a lot of older writers like Comparé and Swift and others, and just wrap my mind around it and really saw it for what it was. And it's, you know, it's very, very profound to understand what we see, you know. I mean, who else understands race but us?
Probably 500 scriptures that point to it, New Testament and Old at least. But yet
it's hidden. It's hidden in a way. There's a fog over it for most people.
Well, what people have the fruits? As a people, Who produces the fruits of the kingdom of heaven?
Oh, only us, no one else.
Who has built all the hospitals? Who has built all the technology? Who has built all of the societies based on law throughout the dawn, since the dawn of time? I mean, not that it, today they're turning out, today it's a lot of it's for the worse because we've been infiltrated by the enemies of God. And we accept the enemies of God. So because we accept the enemies of God, we are being punished. We've accepted the enemies of God and his poison pills and his false doctrines, so we're being punished. We deserve to be. I have one of the items in the banner at the top of Christogenia. I'm going to wait for it. Here it is here. Each who going forth and not abiding in the teaching of Christ has not God. He abiding in the teaching, he also has the Father and the Son. If one comes to you and does not bear this teaching, do not receive him into the house and do not speak to welcome him. For he speaking to welcome him takes a share in his evil works. 2 John 9:11. How could Christians embrace the Jew without spitting in John's face? That's what Christians do. They take the Apostle John and they spit in his face and say, oh, your words aren't good enough. Your walk with Christ was nothing. That's what they say. It's absolutely crazy that Christians embrace. We should never believe these people. We should never accept that any pretense of piety from them. We should not accept their perverted sense of morals. We should not accept them into our nations or into our homes especially. But every time you turn that television on, you've accepted every Jew in Hollywood right into your home. You take a share in their evil works. That's exactly what you do. And that's why we are being punished. As a nation and as a race, we are definitely under punishment. We're being flooded with aliens. All our technology and all our manufacturing capacity has been handed over to our enemies, and we're surrounded by people that hate us. Because we've accepted the enemies of God and put them on a pedestal. All we have to do is shun these people. That's all we have to do is turn away from these people. Turn away from their Hollywood propaganda, from their media propaganda. Stop buying their garbage. Just turn away from them. That's all we have to do. And turn towards God. Am I alone?
Amen.
Amen. That's well said, Bill. I got kicked off. My cell phone just went dead. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I called back in.
I saw that.
I know. We're Judaized from top to bottom. We barely recognize it ourselves sometimes. How much we follow the Jew, you know, how much of the Jew we take in on a daily basis, you know.
It's incredible. And John tells us we should not even speak to welcome them. But he speaking to welcome him takes a share in his evil works. So think about that the next time you want to say hello to a rabbi. Because wherever you've seen a rabbi, you've already seen a one-man walking crime ring. That's what rabbis are.
I greet no rabbi ever. Not anymore.
You're just stepping from one circus ring to another, right?
I got to admit, when I see a Jew now and I know they're a Jew, I look at them and think to myself, and according to the word, I think you can build a strong case for the fact that we have an actual participation in their judgment, in their bundling, and in their burning, as detailed in Matthew chapter 13, and that we participate in that. I don't think we just sit back and watch it. I think Yahweh actually has us involved in it. And I look at them, and I just sense someday you will be bundled and burned, and I will be involved in that. And I glory in that.
Well, however it plays out is by the hand of God. And in the meantime, we have to withdraw from his enemies. That's what's expected of Christians.
Yeah.
He who loves the world is an enemy of God.
But what I'm saying is that I get a small taste of their future judgment when I see them up close, and I sense that their judgment is impending.
Well, I think they sense it too.
Right, exactly. Well said.
And that's
why
they are so paranoid at this day and age that they have to pass all these laws as if laws are going to protect the sinner.
Yeah. No, they're so geared toward this life and this earth and their kingdom in this time right now. They have no concept that they're going to live any eternal life. They know better than that. So you know, that's one reason they're so successful in this age. You know, that and they're so clannish and they help each other out. But they're shooting all their bullets right now in this time, in this age. They live for right now in this moment. And, you know, and they certainly achieve success in this world. Not that they're any more intelligent than us. They're not. But since they own everything and run everything and influence everything, they're able to help their own.
Well, they have a much greater aptitude at knavery. That's that's where they exceed over us. That's where they excel over us.
Their
aptitude for knavery is incredible.
I love that word, knavery. That's a great word.
What's knavery, Bill?
Well, it's knavery is sort of like criminal activity. It's a criminal. It's a being a knave is being a criminal.
Right. A knave, K-N-A-V-E, is an excellent old word. It was like an evil peasant that was criminality.
It has nothing to do with
knavery,
Bruce.
Oh, good.
That there aren't any Jewish sailors anyway. It has nothing to do with the Navy.
Yeah, it was spelled K-N-A-V-E. That's a great word, you know. And they are knaves, you know. They're fugitives, vagabonds, wanderers, but they've elevated themselves to high positions in the world. And they certainly are no smarter than we are.
Well,
probably not as smart.
That they browbeat us with the emotional appeal that we can't be prejudiced in favor of our own. And at the same time, that's all they do is favor their own.
Exactly. You know, I mean, look how, you know, we have yet another Harvard-educated Jew about to become a Supreme Court justice with a Harvard law degree, and she's a professor of law at Harvard. How do you think she got all that? Because she was so super intelligent, or because Jews ran everything and greased the rails so she could slide into those positions as she's sliding into a Supreme Court justice position now? You know?
Right. There'll be like five Jews on the Supreme Court. That's just incredible.
So it is incredible.
Only by their profession, only 3% of the country is Jewish.
Yeah. But we must have 40 to 50% of our Supreme Court to be Jews. What's wrong with that? Everything, of course, is wrong. But
if that's not a takeover, I don't know what is. We may as well disband our Congress and resign ourselves to the Knesset.
Yeah, I mean, we in essence have been taken over. It's just
send
not
all our bills to Israel and let them vote on them.
Yeah. Well, it's probably been that way for the last 30, 40 years anyway.
Well, you're right. It probably has.
I mean, we have a pseudo-Congress and a pseudo-Senate. But in reality, things get passed or don't get passed probably based upon what the Jews want. No one's going to buck the Jews. The Jew overnight can get anyone thrown out of Congress or Senate. That's why Obama's such a puppet.
Well, they brag. I mean, I have an article on the forum somewhere. And it's the La Haaretz newspaper, that Haaretz newspaper bragging about how the Jews have de facto approval status over all the de facto power to approve any of Obama's appointments.
Right. Well, consider if the media turned on Obama with this birth certificate thing, they could have him out in a couple days if they turned the machine on him, and he knows it.
Exactly.
So he is absolutely following the marching orders because he knows if the media machine was turned on him. Right. Right now, they're completely for him and keeping all of this out of the news.
Well, they created him.
Yeah, they created him.
They created, just like they created Clinton, they created him.
But consider how quickly they could have him out if they decided they wanted him out over the birth certificate. He'd be out in a couple days.
Oh, I'm certain.
They could have him out immediately if they so wished. So he marches to the orders he gets, no doubt about it. He just does what he's told. He knows, you know.
No doubt.
Yeah, it's a very degraded situation we find ourselves in. But that's exactly what Enoch prophesied that we would be in. All of this is exactly how it has to be and exactly how it was laid out. And we hate the situation. We see it. We hate it. We hate what we find ourselves in. And even that was prophesied that we would hate the situation.
Well, right. I mean, our kingdom has been handed over to the beast, and it can't possibly be more evident.
Yeah. So Yahweh wants to do something in this generation. You can really sense it. You can feel, can you not feel it just building up and just like that giant oil well that exploded?
Well, yeah, but like a woman in travail right now, the contractions are probably 6 or 7 minutes apart yet.
You know, I was studying this morning in Revelation. I don't remember what chapter, but it talked about where one third of the ocean will become as blood. And I couldn't help but think that this oil disaster perhaps could be the way that's going to happen. Because, you know, most of Revelation is figurative and metaphorical language, you know, describing events. And the way this oil is gushing into the ocean, and they apparently have very little chance of stopping it. They have no concept of how much oil was going to continue to gush. And probably we're not being told the truth about the real amount that's coming out. It's probably a way bigger disaster than what they're letting on. Maybe this is the way that one third of the ocean will be destroyed. Could easily become this if it continues to do what it's doing.
Well, a third of the sea is a third of the masses of people.
Yeah, but it talks about it becoming this blood. I mean, it sounds like it's definitely involving the ocean in a literal sense, too. You know, I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud, but it's clearly a catastrophe. And you know we have catastrophes coming up.
Well, yeah, but we've had the catastrophes for the last 100 years. You know how many people died the last 100 years in a war?
No.
How many white Christians died the last 100 years? 50-something
It's hard to put a number on.
Died in World War II.
Many tens of millions at least, probably hundreds of millions.
30 to 40 million due to the Bolshevik Revolution. The Jewish machinations killed 100 million Christians in Europe in the last century.
Yeah. 100 million is probably a conservative figure.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. And yet we have to have countless museums commemorating the falsely 6 million Jews.
Well, for the 3 Jews that died in Nazi concentration camps.
Yeah, of typhus.
I think it was 3. I remember I was there. I'm a survivor. I saw 3 Jews die at Auschwitz.
I was there too.
I'm a Holocaust survivor too. I was there.
Yeah, it must have happened. We were there. I've heard people say that.
I threw apples across the barbed wire to feed the starving children. I'm going to write a book about it.
Yeah, you know, the New York Times, it's still in my notes. I'm going to scan it. I'm going to get it out one day soon and scan it. I have a picture, this picture of the liberation of Auschwitz by Soviet troops that ran in the New York Times about 5 or 6 years ago. And this picture shows a whole bunch of kids and women, fat, happy, and smiling. It's incredible. I mean, that they didn't look like they were starving to death or emaciated at all. Fat, happy, smiling children.
Those were the ones that didn't. Those were the ones that didn't come over and work in the White House, right?
Yeah. Well, they all did. That's the problem.
I know.
Hitler didn't gas 6 million Jews. If he did, we wouldn't have Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod and 2.5 million survivors. I think it's up to now. I mean, it started out at like 1 million, but now it's up to about 2.5 million.
I see we have many Holocaust survivors in the chat room. I'm glad to see that tonight.
Gerald said his grandmother is a lampshade. He sold her on eBay. That's pretty funny. Yeah, it's incredible. The lies are incredible. This entire culture is a culture of lies.
It is.
The entire Jewish culture is a culture of lies. And that's what we have. This is not a Christian culture anymore. It hasn't been a Christian culture since probably the 1880s, if you ask me. I mean, I know that there were a lot of holdouts here and there, but they're gone now.
You know, concerning World War II, Bill and Greg, you know, I think Adolf Hitler really, really did a fine, wonderful job exposing that Canaanite element in Germany.
And that's why they hate him so much, Bruce. That's why they really hate him so much, because he wrote the truth about them.
But what I'm saying is that the Jews attempt to promote that Hitler was a propagandist. And all I'm saying is that he was exposing propaganda. And there's a big difference.
Well, right. Absolutely. They like to say that Hitler invented the big lie. Hitler didn't invent the big lie. He was describing what they do. That's exactly what he was doing.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm German, and I believe that the Holocaust story is the biggest hate crime against my race. Because it didn't happen. And it's a Jewish perpetrated hate crime against the German people. And I take offense to it.
And I think most all of us have a relative or somebody they know that was affected by these satanic Canaanite Jews, you know. Well, obviously, but I mean during World War II and all of the Vietnamese war and everything.
That was yet another war that should never have happened.
Yeah.
Whites killing whites, Jews sitting back, rubbing their hands and, you know, enjoying their harvest while whites by the millions die.
Well, they were making the world safe for Jewish capitalism so that we could have cheap shoes and cheap radios and stuff like that 50 years later.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was about. So we could have keys for $8,000. Brought to you by the Jew on Wall Street 50 years later.
And, of course, also so the Jew could steal the land in Palestine and have their own country as a criminal world headquarters. Also one of the main reasons behind World War II. Our history has been perverted utterly.
I was told that more of our kinsmen coming back from Vietnam committed suicide than actually died in that war. But we never hear about the numbers of our kinfolk in Germany and in this country that had the same sort of fate following the war. Because war is that kind of a war. We're never given the true numbers, you know, about how many really did die as a result of that war.
Well, it's incredible. There's been a huge white Holocaust for over 100 years now.
Yes, sir.
That's the real Holocaust.
Exactly, Bill. The real Holocaust has been the last 100 years. And our race has been the ones that have, you know, been the slaughtered ones. Tens and tens of millions of our brethren murdered by the Jew. Either the Jew directly or the Jew directing us to kill each other. You know?
Well, right. And we've, I think those, I mean, sometimes they get awfully gory, but I think that those Sunday night programs I've done with Sword Brethren have you know, that every American should have to listen to those programs. Every American should have to listen to the, have to read the Russia number one report. And the Germany and the Jewish problem, and it's incredible that we don't teach those things in schools today. That they don't even want them out there. That they'll pull them from the internet if they could.
Now we have entire weeks and multiple weeks of elementary and junior high school dedicated to Holocaust Memorial Weeks. I just was reading about it today. Certain schools will have an entire week dedicated to remembering the Holocaust and kids will be forced to write letters to each other pretending that they're Jews in concentration camps, pretending ready to be killed, and they have to write letters pretending they're Jews. Total brainwashing.
Now, one thing, I got to get my birthday. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's pretty disgusting. That's absolutely disgusting. And it is a brainwashing.
And it's all it is. It's they're beating these kids and their parents over the head nonstop. 6 million Jews were killed. Therefore, the Jew is the victim, and they're a victim people. And no matter what they do, we have to allow it because of what happened, and white guilt syndrome, and on and on and on, and it never ends.
Well, that's exactly what it is. They've set up this huge matrix. They set up this huge systemized deception that allows them to get away with any crime whatsoever.
Because they went through, they're justified to do anything they want to.
You can float crosses in glass jars full of urine in this nation, but you can't say anything bad about the enemies of God. You can't say anything bad about the enemies of Christ, because then you'll be demonized.
Well, I can. You can.
Well, of course we can, Bruce, but we're demonized.
Oh, who cares? We've ran with the devil long enough in the past. No.
My point is to illustrate the hypocrisy that's out there in the world. That's my point. That's why James said, a friend of the world is an enemy of God.
Yep.
Not too many of us are friends of the world in Christian identity. It's hard to be a friend of this world, seeing what we see. We basically feel like the true outcasts.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the realization of the truth proves and demonstrates the truth of every verse in the Bible. Hello, Patricia.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
How you doing?
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Patricia. Good to see you again.
Thanks. Good to be seen, such as it is. I had a fun day today. I just wanted to call and tell you. I mean, I was in, finding out how Verizon was, charging me so much on different crap. I mean, it's unbelievable, how they were doing it. And I'll probably save this conversation sometime when Matt's here and we can have phone wars. But RP had noticed it the other day, and I noticed it. Verizon, when you go into their stores, all their big, glossy advertising, display advertising that they have up around the store, there's not one white person in sight. No one is white in their advertising.
Well, because whites are a thing of the past, and the future is brown.
Exactly. So I said so I couldn't help myself when I finally got up to a representative, I said, I'm starting to wonder if Verizon's kind of racist. And they said, what? And I go, well, look at all the advertising, and there's not one white person.
Turn it around on them. That's good.
I was talking with a white guy, and he goes, no, that's I'm white. And I go, yeah, so am I, but do you see any pictures of white people here? I mean, it was pretty funny. So they were just disgusted, like, oh, who's this crazy woman, But I guarantee they will not be able to stop looking at their own advertising. I mean, it was funny. So that was, and I had an interesting conversation. I sat down, there was an Asian lady sitting on the bench, and she said, saw me, we had a long wait. She says, oh, come sit down, So I sat down, and she told me she was there. She goes, oh, watch your purse. Mine just got stolen, and I had to, blah, 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 this kind of stuff. And so we got talking. Turns out she married a military guy, and that's why she lived in the U.S., and she had lived all over Germany and Washington, D.C., and Arizona and stuff. And she was really on it. She said to me, what has happened to this government? This is not like the United States anymore. And she talked to me, and I said, yeah, what do you think of the news, what they show on this? She said, that's not news. There's no truth. They don't speak any truth. I mean, and I don't even bother to vote anymore, she said. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I go, wow, that's really interesting. And a white Asian person, I was pretty amazed. So, And so I asked her, I said, well, how many people do you talk to that, you know, get what you're saying? She goes, about 30%, she said. I go, wow.
And they're probably Asian, too, because white people won't wake up. It's incredible.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I just had to tell you a little bit of fun I had at Verizon today. Just couldn't help myself. Oh, and I had a nice talk, nice little talk with Richard Kelly Hoskins this morning. How nice was that?
Oh, yeah. How's he doing?
Well, he's going to be doing better. I sent him some CardioPrim, so... He says the only thing that works on him is his head. The rest of him is falling apart. So
he's got to be 80 years old. I mean, he's up there.
He said 81. So
81,
that's right.
Okay.
I told him I'd get him feeling 50 again. So I sent him some out today. So he was pretty stoked about that. So that was cool. Yep.
Always enjoyed his writing. He has some strange ideas, but I always liked his writing.
Yeah, he's, you know, that's okay. He's entitled, you know. So it was fun. He says he runs his dogs in the morning, you know, takes his dogs for a run. Since he can't walk very far, he just goes out in the car and lets them, you know, run after the car. And then he honks the horn twice, and that's their signal to get back in the car.
Okay.
I thought that was pretty funny. So, well, that's all I really had to say. Great. Hey, Greg, great teaching yesterday. That was really awesome.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that program.
Thank you.
You are the Enoch expert. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. And I've got to get to reading that book. But I'm telling you, start with number one or number, you know, is there one place to start? Because it's hard to get into.
I would start with one, then go to two, then go to three.
Okay.
They're all three incredible. I mean, every one of those three books is just very, very profound. Just start reading. Just jump in.
Okay. All right. It's hard to get used to all the different names and everything, but that's okay. It's just a matter of jumping in. Okay, I'll do it. Okay, so I sent Samson something stupid today, Bill, but you'll see.
Oh, that was great of you.
No. Oh, no. It's stupid. you'll see. He'll see what I'm doing. So.
Samson does not have enough toys. I play a game with him every morning in the kitchen now. He gathers his toys, and he tries to hover himself over them to protect them. So he has like four or five toys laying around the kitchen floor, and I'll kick one, and he'll pounce on it, and I'll kick another one, and he'll grab the first one with his jaw and go and pounce on the second one. So then I'll find a squeak toy or a third one, and I'll start stepping on that or kicking that. And he gathers them all. He's incredibly protective. It's really pretty funny. But Samson's trying to drag three toys around to protect the fourth because he doesn't want to be playing with his toys. It's pretty funny. It's entertaining.
Well, he knows you can't be trusted with those squeak toys, Bill.
Yeah. Yeah, Samson's he's huge too. He's over 30 pounds now, and he's about four times the size he was when we brought him home.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he'll be eating my food soon.
Yeah, just getting started.
And
yeah,
I'll be fighting with him over my own food soon.
Okay, well, I just think we all should go into the Verizon store and have some fun with him. So.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's the future is brown. That's the way it is. It's not bright, that's for sure. And that's, you know, the big corporations are really playing up to that, and that's what they want, and that's what they see coming, and that's what they're pushing.
Well, the fact that when you have white advertising, like wasn't it Abercrombie and Fitch that got in trouble for their advertising was too white? They said that they had to color it up a little bit.
Right. And I wouldn't even buy anything from them anymore because they caved in and they forked over the money and that was it. They just rolled over. I mean, I never bought anything from them in the first place, but if I ever had the opportunity to, I would think about that and I just wouldn't do it. I don't buy anything from any of those companies. I buy the clothes I have come from obscure companies and the clothes are still made here. Even my jeans are made here. I wouldn't buy a pair of Levi's. I'd walk around in Amish pants first, I swear. I'd have to go to an Amish town and buy some clothes.
Levi Strauss, kind of a Jewish-sounding name, huh?
Well, they sold out. They sold out a long time ago. I mean, they Dockers and things like that were never made here.
Well, I don't know. Levi Strauss could have been a good German name at that time.
They could have been, but they don't bear that fruit now.
No. Oh, Diamond Gusset Jeans made in Tennessee. You got to give us a website for that, MacDog. That sounds like an important kind of jeans.
Yeah, you know, I don't know where the jeans I bought were made, but I'm going to get the card out. And they're pretty good. I mean, they're as good as Levi's, and they're made here. It's like allamericanclothing.com or something like that. And they were only, allamericanclothing, all one word, .com. And they were only $30 a pair. And they're made here, probably by Mexican sweatshop workers, though.
Well, I tend to believe Yahweh made your jeans there, Bill.
Thanks.
The other kinds of jeans, right, exactly. The genetic kind. Cool. Well, I just want to call in and tell you I've had a good time at Verizon. I've got some work to do here, and I'm going to be listening. I'll talk to you all later.
Y'all
bless.
Good to talk to Patricia. Bill, do you think there's any companies left in this world that the Jew hasn't bought or owned?
Well, I mean, we should probably buy everything that we can from small mom and pop outfits and locally made outfits.
Yeah.
And even if they have a few aliens working for them, at least the money stays here and is probably spent here for the most part. That's you have to support your local community first. That's the only way that we could walk.
I mean, apart from the last 2 years, I worked for what is currently now the largest pharmaceutical company in the world after their large merger with Pfizer. And I just have a view that every large company in this world, forget what industry it is, doesn't matter, it's owned by Jews. And you try to find the ownership of certain large companies. You get online, you start digging down, trying to drill down. It's very difficult to uncover the ownership of the major corporations. I've come to the conclusion that they're all owned by the international Jew, the top Jewish families. I would guess that the Rothschilds own the vast majority of them, certainly control the vast majority of corporations in this world with their colossal multi-trillion
The big mechanism they use to control companies is share classes. That's first. They love splitting shares into classes and have voting classes and non-voting classes and selling all of the non-voting classes off to the public.
And they also, they have these various registries of various companies. And, I mean, it's hard to pin down who owns some of these massive international corporations. Pharmaceutical companies might be one of the best examples of the giant oil companies.
A long time ago, about 10 years ago, probably the Wall Street Journal ran an article on the Wallenbergs. I mean, Jews tell on each other all the time, right? They ran this article on the Wallenbergs. The Wallenbergs are a Jewish family that has occupied territory in Sweden now for about 150 years.
Yeah.
Maybe longer than that, right?
I've heard of the family. I know the name.
Well, they controlled all of the major corporations in Sweden. They controlled Volvo. They controlled Electrolux, Ericsson, and 11 large corporations, I think it was, in Sweden. They controlled SK, which is a big machine tools and machine parts company. The Wallenbergs controlled all these companies. They had control over the boards of all these companies, but they only owned or controlled 8 to 20% of the shares of the companies.
Right.
But they would leverage that into getting 3 out of 7 board seats or 2 out of 5 board seats. And that way they would basically control the company.
Right. Yeah, enough control to control the company. If that family controls that, imagine what the Rothschilds control. Yet they've mastered keeping their name out of the press. And every time I read like the Fortune 100 or top 200-300 wealthiest people in the world, how fascinating that you don't even see their names on those lists, when in reality they probably have a greater wealth than those top 100 people combined. Yet their name doesn't even show up on the list because they probably own Forbes magazine.
Well, right.
It's really an amazing thing.
The rich don't show up on the rich. We don't see Rothschilds in the Forbes 1000.
No.
But you won't either.
And yet they probably, I mean, it's really hard to estimate their wealth. I've read estimates of their wealth that it's in the quadrillions, which is 1,000. Quadrillion is 1,000 trillion dollars, I believe. Or is that 1,000 billion?
I'm trying to think of which early Christian writer it was that said that the Jews should be allowed to keep nothing that they've gained by usury. Everything they have, they've gained by usury.
I like that. I would vote for that.
I forget which. It was one of the early. He was actually a Catholic, maybe around the 6th or 7th century. And I can't remember which one it was.
Was that Apostle Paul? If any man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat.
Well, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the beginning of it, right? Well, no, it was an early Catholic writer, maybe around the 6th century, that said that the Jews shouldn't keep anything that they've gained by usury.
That was an enlightened mind that came up with it.
Well, the early Catholic writers were actually, to a great extent, enlightened. I mean, there was a lot of error there, don't get me wrong, with the ritualism, the sacramentalism. But a lot of the early Catholic writers and the early Christian writers did have a lot on the ball. And one thing that the early Romish church did right, under Theodosius II, that they banned Jews from public office. They banned Jews from holding Christian slaves. And they prevented Christians from borrowing at usury and Jews from loaning to Christians. And that basically locked Satan into the pit for 1,000 years.
Bill, do you know when the last Jewish expulsion was, approximately?
The last Jewish expulsion from anywhere? I have a list somewhere of Jewish expulsions.
And so do I. I didn't know if you knew it right off. I'm guessing it was quite some time ago, at least 100 years ago, I would guess.
Well, yeah, it was probably a couple hundred years ago, but I'm going to go look for that list and see if I can't find it.
My thought is that we're way overdue for one. And actually, our country would do well to have such a one. And
Well, we should restate this and say the last successful Jewish expulsion, because Hitler really did try.
Unfortunately, they have really done a masterful job as the perfect parasite of so attaching themselves into this country. I don't know how we could get rid of them at this point, apart from Yahweh doing it, which will be the ultimate Jewish expulsion, and I can't wait for that day. But it would be damn hard to get rid of them. they own everything. They run everything. They control everything. It'd be pretty tough for us to throw them out. They would put up a hell of a fight, you know?
Well, you know, a good benediction.
Well, it's not going to happen until the wheat and the tares are finally separated. It's not going to happen, and we shouldn't
it's past the point where we can do anything about it.
It's this country is way past the point where we could ever take it back. Only intervention we're the only hope we have is the intervention of God Himself, and that's the Christian promise. That's the Christian promise. I mean, that's the biblical promise, and if we can't believe the biblical promise and accept that, I mean, seeing all the prophecy that has come true, we have to take it for granted, Christians, and have faith that we will prevail.
Praise Yahweh, I totally agree with that, yes.
But we have no we have no ability to act on our own, period. It's not going
to
happen.
Point. We're conquered.
Everybody who tries to act on his own is going to fail. We're doomed to failure. It's the vanity of the flesh that imagines that we could fix this country, that we could fix our land. The word says that when my people who are called by my name hear my voice and turn to me, that I will fix their land. That's what the word says. That's the word of God. We can only turn to obedience and persuade our brethren, and they're going to be punished until they repent. That's the way it is. The punishment is going to endure, and it's going to come to the point where they see that they have no other choice.
Yeah. Bill, I came up with a good list here on my files of Jewish expulsions. The most recent one I have is 1948 from Arab countries. Before that, 1938 under Nazi-controlled areas. And I have 1919 in Bavaria, in parentheses, foreign-born Jews. And then
right. That was only foreign. Right, exactly. They helped foreign. There were a lot of Soviet agents in Bavaria that helped the Red Republic of Bavaria, Bavaria was actually a Soviet socialist state for a couple of days, I think. They actually came very close to a complete takeover in Bavaria.
Then I go back to 1891 Moscow, in the 1880s Russia, 1866 Galatz, Russia, Romania.
Right,
so,
I have a whole list that I downloaded recently, and I can't find it. I may have posted it already and don't remember where I posted it. I've done things like that. I'll come across it, though.
I wonder if you have the same list I have. It's like it says 109 locations where Jews have been expelled since AD 250.
I have one folder on my data drive with 1,365 files in 56 directories, 8.89 gigabytes, and that's the stuff that I want to post. That's books and articles, and it's all stuff that I would like to post, but it's a matter of time.
I'm posting the link here where I got this information.
And that doesn't include the 11,000 articles and books that I have that are eventually going to go on the New Ensign site. And the Greek Septuagint I'm trying to get up on Christogenia as this past week that I've started posting this week because I want to eventually translate it.
My whole point was we're way overdue for the ultimate expulsion. And may Yahweh have it soon.
Billy, your son is talking to you. I'm sorry. I haven't paid attention. Good night, Billy. If you're still, I love you. I'll talk to you soon. Call me tomorrow or the next day if you can. We haven't spoken in 2 weeks.
Good night, Billy. Hey, the explosion in Obadiah isn't really an explosion. It's more of
final expulsion. The once and for all, and we never do it again expulsion.
Yeah, kind of like a kite. We'll have to get the kite sauce out and have a barbecue then. But, you know, it's interesting. Do you see in the scriptures how that the satanic Canaanite bloodline Jews, they control the world and Satan rules the world, but the earth is Yahweh's. Do you see that? You see that replete through the scriptures? It seems that it's, the Jew isn't the natural indigenous creation. It's more of a seduction of the fallen nature, and so they're not really, they don't inherit the earth. But the earth is Yahweh's, and he's given to the sons of men. Right. So I don't know. I think it's. You understand what I'm getting at, though. Hello.
Please rephrase it. I'm being honest. I'm sorry. I.
Well, like the Yahweh, who's the Lord of all the earth, the olive sticks. And the olive stands and the candlesticks.
Well,
right.
And Satan thinks he rules the world, and Yahweh's permissive will allows him to do that.
That's right.
Because Eve was deceived, mm-hmm. and because Adam claimed his wife, after that deception, Cain has the right to the firstborn. The rights of the firstborn. There's no way around that in Scripture. There's no way around it. I mean, Cain was told that he would rule over Abel. And Seth's children are replacements for Abel. There's no way around that in Scripture. And that's how come Satan was able to tell Christ that the whole world was his. And he gives it to whoever he will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Satan doesn't understand it. Well, they do, I think, but they would never admit it, that Yahshua Christ is the true firstborn. Because he is Yahweh.
And when the prince of this world is cast out, that means to say that when he comes again, he'll be taking all of these kingdoms away from these
the prince of the world was cast out. With the advent, when Christianity became the ruling philosophy of Europe, the prince of this world was cast out for 1,000 years.
Yeah, but it's just a short little lease.
Well, now he has his short little lease back, right. It's a matter of prophecy that we were to be punished and our kingdom handed over to the beast for a short time. And that he knows he has just a short time. And that's the way they act. They act like they have just a short time. I mean, anybody that knows the Scripture and sees what's going on in the world has to believe it. It's incredible that more people don't see it. Because they simply don't want to accept the fact that Satan is Satan. They don't want.
Yeah. Well, the movement of our great King and Savior, Yahshua Christ, that movement's eternal. And, I mean, it's so important every day to...
Right. 21, the Jews were excoriated from Christian society from the time of Theodosius II until the time of the Demedicis, when they started getting back in. And that's the Enlightenment. And under the Demedici popes, who were actually a Jewish banking family that supplied 3 popes to the Romish Church in the 1500s, usury became permissible because the church redefined it. And when the church redefined usury from meaning the loaning of money at interest to the loaning of money at too much interest, that opened the door for the Jews to again gain control of the world. And that period from Theodosius until the Demedicis and the Enlightenment, that period was the 1,000-year kingdom. And with the Enlightenment and the admission of usury into Europe, the Jew has again come to rule over us. Satan has again come to rule over the world and is deceiving the nations as we speak, Revelation chapter 20. I got a program on it on my website. You should probably listen to it. Clifton and I did a program on it a few months ago. I'm sorry, Revelation chapter 20. Yeah, chapter 20. I don't think it's 21. I think it is 20. That 1,000 years is in the past. I'm looking for the program, Bruce. You'll have to excuse me. I mean, you could say something and help me out here. Bruce, say something.
Sorry, Phil, I spaced out.
Well, Adolf Hitler will be in the resurrection. There is no doubt about it. And a whole lot of Jews and Christians are going to be mad at that.
Not me. I've read his book. He saw a lot.
Adolf Hitler was an excellent Christian that just... Well, I mean, David said, and Paul quoted... But all day like sheep, we are slain in the slaughter. That's the way it is. That's part of our punishment.
Yeah, and walking by sight in this stupid world with our stupid vanity, if we walk by sight in all that, well, of course we're going to be discouraged and bow down and give up. But those things that are not seen are so much more of a reality than what we see with our physical eyes.
There's a Sword Brothers sent me some films. That there's one that there is one film on the Mind Comp site from that I downloaded from YouTube that is such a perfect illustration of not Hitler's profession of Christianity. He did not profess very often. He did on occasion, but he did not wear his Christianity on his sleeve. It permeated his political philosophy. And there's one film there where he talks about how opportunities should be provided for the downtrodden. They shouldn't get handouts. They should get opportunity, and the rich and the wealthy people should pitch in and give the downtrodden in Germany the opportunity to lift themselves up. That's Christianity permeating the man's political philosophy. There, every aspect of his political philosophy reflected his Christian faith. And it's unmistakable. And anybody that thinks that Hitler was a demon and he wasn't a Christian is absolutely out of their minds. The demons and the enemies of Christ are those who accuse him.
I agree, Bill. I've read Mein Kampf, and his belief in Yahweh just shows through in multiple places. I mean, you're right. He doesn't wear it on his sleeve, but he's the leader of a nation, and a leader of a nation has to kind of walk a different path than, say, you or I do, you know? And I agree with you completely. You could sense he was truly a Christian, and he understood who the Jew was and the evil of the Jew, you know? And, of course, he's been completely maligned in history as an amazingly great murderer, which is nonsense. It wasn't that at all. We've been taught so wrong. Our history has been so distorted and perverted. I can't get over how much falseness I was taught coming up through high school and college, all the nonsense that I picked up. No.
The video I was talking about, they call me Kaiser, just pasted it into the forum from YouTube, and that's the one that I posted on the Mein Kampf site this week.
That's a great one to watch for some truth.
Oh yeah, I mean there's tons of them. I mean I'm surprised there are so many of these still around. I'm shocked, but yeah, I just this week I posted the I had an abridged version of Hitler's first speech in power, and I just obtained the entire thing from YouTube and posted it all on the Mein Kampf site. It's on the front page, and I obtained his entire declaration of war against the United States and posted it all. And then that video that they call me Kaiser just posted is also on the front page of the Mein Kampf site, and it's titled Hitler's Struggle Against Zionism and Bolshevism. And that's a really good video.
There really is some outstanding stuff still on YouTube. I'm surprised. Sometimes it's shocking what you still can find on
there. I'm shocked that this stuff is still around, that people are still posting it, and we're indebted to the people that post this stuff, because there's many of this. I grab all I can and that I think is worthy and put it on my Mein Kampf site, because I would like to have it all in one place. But and I would like to preserve it. But, yeah, as many of us have to copy this stuff as possible and spread it around.
I love watching that video, The Eternal Jew. I never get tired of watching that. That's one of the great videos ever.
Mein Kampf site embedding. Yeah, you know, I think all these videos can be embedded. And that's, I encourage people to embed them, because the YouTubes, they disappear quick.
Yeah. You've seen that video, The Eternal Jew. It's like a 6-part video.
No, it's a 1-part movie on my Mein Kampf site.
Oh, you got the whole thing. Okay. That is such a classic. I bet I've watched that a dozen times, and I never get tired of watching it.
Yeah, actually, Sword Brethren had that on DVD and sent it to me, and I ripped it and put it on my site.
Yeah, that's a must-watch for anyone new to CI that is interested in racial matters. I mean, it was maybe originally done as a so-called propaganda piece, but it is what it is. It's truth. It's who they really are, you know? It's really a masterpiece of racial education. it's worth watching more than once.
Yeah, it's amazing how Yahweh, you know, exposing this satanic element called the Jew, the very scene of that disorder, the very scene of it is Yahweh's order and rational, sane mind, you know. But how many our kinfolk can break that shell? It's not really a matter of numbers.
Well, not too many managed to. It seems like I don't know. It's
a pretty soft shell, but there's just too many hard hearts is the problem, I think.
Exactly. It's easy to become discouraged, but we can't be. We have to continue to stand in the truth against all the adversity. It's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and when we have our senses exercised and disciplined to see these things, and it's not a shock for us, but it is
right.
A very fearful thing for those who aren't prepared.
And that's the patience of the saints, right?
Hello, Clifton.
Hey, get Clifton to call in. Somebody better call in. I mean, not that you guys aren't doing well, but this program's all about being a forum, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to jump in tonight, Bill. I just had my spirit was just hungry for.
Nah, that's okay. I feel bad for you. I'm sorry your life didn't go the other. Your life and your relationship with your wife didn't go the other way. But there are a lot of women in the same predicament with unbelieving husbands. And I know. I'm in pretty close contact with one in Pennsylvania who. Her husband has actually had a lot of turmoil over this message, and can't. He's so troubled over her acceptance of it, and she's standing fast in the truth, and I'm proud of her, but she has to, you know, when I fully advised her to, she's a woman, and she should submit herself to her husband while not bending on the truth, and she's been standing tall in that, and I'm proud of her, but I hope that her husband comes around eventually, or at least learns to leave her alone about it.
Well, I'm clear that Joshua... Messiah came to bring a sword onto this earth, not to bring peace, and that there will be division, and that it has to be in a certain way, but certain beliefs cannot be compromised, you know? And, you see a thing, you see the truth, and you realize you have to go a particular way, and you give someone an opportunity to go with you. And you show them what you've seen, and they either decide that, yes, they can go this way, or no, they cannot. And if they cannot, and you can't drag them along, then, you know, life gives you opportunities to go different directions. My marriage has been 32 years. That's how long I've been married.
Wow.
And I have 4 kids.
Is it 4? Okay, I didn't know if it was 3 or how many.
I have 4. And I've prayed a lot about it. And everything that I've seen and that Yahweh has shown me is beyond anything I can compromise. I can't compromise on any of it because I see it too clearly. And I've invited her to come along with me. And she's decided that she cannot come this way. So... You know, I at this point, I'm very peaceful to have a temporary separation, and we'll see what plays out. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking with Eli about it, and he's told me he's seen many families break up over Christian identity, which is a sad thing, but I'm just at a point where I cannot compromise what I've seen and what I've been shown. I refuse to compromise on it. By that, I mean I refuse to have anything to do with other races that are so-called Christians. You know, I don't care if someone's a dark race and they carry a Bible and say they believe in Jesus.
Well, right. They should carry it somewhere else.
I can have I have nothing to do with that. I don't care how sincere they appear, what Bible they carry. It doesn't matter. I see no basis in the Word that they can even come to Yahshua Christ, let alone that I can allow them into my life and my house and my family. So that to me is a point I cannot compromise on. And if that's what we end up breaking up over, then that's the way it has to be.
Well, that's the noble route to take. I mean, obey God and not man. And that's the way it should be. And that includes your wife. Yeah, you know, Paul gives advice in that respect. And he says that if the unbeliever wants to stay with you, that's fine. Yeah, you know, but if not, that's just the way it is.
That's just the way it is.
But you can't compromise your faith.
And I refuse to do it. And I've spent a lot of time in prayer about it, and there's no room for me to compromise on this matter. I cannot. The matter of race is too critical. So we're going to separate and take a break and see how it plays out, you know. I'm very peaceful about the way it's working out. I appreciate how the saints have prayed for me, and I continue to ask you to pray. But this is working out as it, I think, is meant to be, so we'll see how it is. I'll have my own place in about a month. Kind of excited about it, really. I haven't been alone for about 30-some years, so it'll be interesting.
You want some cooking tips?
I'm a master cook.
Good.
Grill and S&B.
That's usually the first problem guys have, that's all.
Not me. I do 99% of the cooking here. I'm actually an excellent cook. So, I worry how they're going to eat when I leave.
I got a can opener and tomato soup and chicken noodle soup and a can opener. That's funny.
Interestingly enough, I'm also a connoisseur of wines. So I'm pretty dialed into eating and having a nice glass of wine on a regular basis. I've already got Eli coming up for a visit sometime later this summer. So,
that's great, but when you coming this way?
I'm coming down. My life will probably simplify here in about a month. If I'm invited, I'll come down. I want to see your dog.
Anytime you want to come.
I want to see your dog. You say he's gotten 4 times bigger than when you got him?
Oh, yeah, he's over 30 pounds. He was only about 12 pounds when we got him. And he's only 12 weeks old, 13 weeks old, I think.
Mm.
Yeah,
good to have a dog. They're the ultimate pet.
My cut and paste isn't working between machines, and it's frustrating me. It's supposed to work from one machine, one computer to the other, and it's not. I control 2 computers with 1 mouse and keyboard, and the cut and paste usually works, but the last few days it hasn't worked, and I'm in a quandary as to why. I sound like a spoiled techno brat, I'm sure, but hello, John.
Hey, good evening, fellas.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Yourself?
Great. I want to paste in these links, and I got them on one computer, and I want to get them to the other one, and usually my cut and paste works, and it won't. Okay, I'll stop complaining. I'll just save a text file and upload it to my... That's a lot of trouble to go through. So what's happening? What can I do for you tonight? Or what can't I do for you tonight? Depending on which way you want to look at it.
I got a few more questions.
Sure.
All right. I want to know, who did Seth marry?
Who did Seth marry? Who did any of them marry?
I know. They had to marry their sisters, didn't they?
Well, no, they didn't marry their sisters, because that would be that would be a horrible thing. A lot of people, and a lot of the apocryphal works say they married their sisters, but I don't accept those apocryphal works as canonical. The bottom line, and this is what I believe, and I can't prove it, that the Genesis 1:26 through 28, and I have this illustrated on the overview pages of my website, which are still incomplete, but which I'm planning on getting back to as soon as I can. Genesis 1:26-28 describes to me a plural creation of our race. Genesis from and Genesis chapter 1 should probably end at Genesis 2:3, right? And Genesis 2:4 through the end of Genesis chapter 4 describe the fall of our race and as it's attributed to the leading family or Adam and Eve. But that is not necessarily a literal factual account. What it is a parable representing historic events. That's what I believe.
So you don't believe Adam was a real person?
Well, yes, I believe Adam was a real person. And he's the patriarch. He's blamed for the sin in the garden that his wife surely partook in, but that there were other Adamites in that creation. That's what I believe.
Why would they be punished then?
Why would they be punished? Well, because the entire race was punished for the transgression. And I can't prove that, but it's the only way that makes sense to me. He created them male and female, Genesis 1:26-28.
Well, didn't it say that Eve had to become the mother of all humanity, all mankind?
The mother of all living.
Right.
Well, define living in the eyes of God is not living in the eyes of man.
You lost me.
Not all men have that spirit that produces life. Living in the eyes of God is not living in the eyes of man.
That would seem kind of strange. There are other humans in existence at the time that did not have the same type of...
No, there were other Adamites, I'm sure. That's what I believe. That might be wrong, but it can't be proven either way.
Well,
there are questions either way that cannot be answered. They cannot be definitively answered.
Well, so let me postulate this to you, that there was no prohibition against acquiring a sister for marriage at that point.
Well, it's a natural law of God, it seems to me. And the law existed right from Adam. I believe that. It's evident that they knew the right between right and wrong. I mean, Adam is shown every creature, names every creature. I believe that that's a parable that tells us that Adam knew which people and beings on earth were worthy of reproduction and which were not. Which can be eaten and which were not. In other words, he was told that the values of every living species. And knew not the race mix. Right from the beginning, he knew not the race mix.
Well, there was only one thing prohibited to them. So why not have your sister as a marriage mate?
Well, that's what you say there was one thing prohibited to them, because that's the one that's stressed in the parable, but it's a parable.
Yeah, like, isn't that, can I say something? Isn't it when he said thou shalt can eat of any tree in the garden but that one?
H.J. Woman, the laws weren't enacted with Moses. The natural laws of God, I mean, the moral laws have always been around. Abraham was considered righteous because he kept Yahweh's statutes and his laws and his judgments. That's five generations, six, seven generations before Moses.
Well, things became more natural after that. It became obvious, okay, go back.
Well, that's, you know, that's attributes that men are giving to the scripture that aren't necessarily there.
Right, true, I'll grant you that. But being so close, being the only couple, I mean, there was no choice then. And then maybe the law just naturally kicked in after that.
Well, the law of kind after kind is the first law mentioned in the Bible. It's mentioned in Genesis chapters 1 and 2 about 10 times, I think, or something. I don't know. It's in the early chapters of Genesis at least 10 times. That's the first word of God, kind after kind. That's the absolute first dictate of God to man, kind after kind, in the Bible, and it's repeated 10 times. Everything after its kind.
It doesn't seem to make sense to me to have other kinds of, like, Adam and Eve out there without, I mean, you had to start from somewhere, right?
Well, right, it did have to start from somewhere, but I believe that Genesis 1, 26 through 27, let us make man in our image, and male and female he created them, and we're not told the details. And Genesis 2 is a parable, and Eve being taken from Adam, that represents the truth. And that teaches us what our wife should be, flesh of our flesh and bone of our bone. And that the entire stress in those chapters is on keeping your race pure. That every species should keep its race pure. That's the law of God. And that's the first law of God. And everything else is secondary.
Yeah, you know, you read the Bible and you get that sense of it, that it's a very physical, I should say, in the sense of how describing how you should be, it describes things physically very carefully.
Right, and this is God's creation, and racism is the respect for the creation of God and the wishing to keep it as he created it. Where anti-racism, multiculturalism, diversity, race mixing, that is expressed by the Jew first, and that is an exposition of his hatred of God's natural order.
That definitely makes sense to me. Like, because let's say, I mean, even in the United Nations and all around the world, people accept that genocide is a crime against God and man. And yet, when people marry outside their race or race mix, they're actually doing that, and that's a crime.
Right, it is a crime.
And yet, people don't think anything of it as if it's not a crime.
Because the Jew has pummeled into our head for 120 years through the media, through Hollywood, through music, that it's actually good to race mix. Most people today think that race mix, and they think they're doing God a favor.
I thought it was good, too, because I thought, you know, the gene pool would get better. You know?
Well, right, but it gets worse. Look at Egypt. It was once the leading white nation, and so was Persia at one time, the leading white nation. The highest, the marvels, you know, most of the wonders of the ancient world came from Greece and Persia and Egypt. And they're all gone. Those people can't, the only wonder that they can create today is to wonder how the hell they're still alive. Because they're all basket cases.
Yeah, they are. Because, you know, actually, I support a little Egyptian girl. I mean, she looks half white. She looks almost
Well,
white.
She probably is half white.
Yeah.
That's the truth. It's a shame, but that's what happened. I mean, they're Arabs.
Yeah. And the funny thing about it is that I told them, I said, I want to support a child in Eurasia. And they sent me someone to Egypt. I couldn't find anyone in all of Russia, any kid in all of Russia I could support.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you thought you were doing a noble thing at the time. And that's, you know, a lot of Americans and people that come to the truth are faced with situations like that. That's the way it is.
Well, I told them specifically Eurasia, and they didn't do it.
No, they don't care. They figure they got you.
Whatever. I mean, that's
that's all those charities are crooked as hell. I don't. That they're all Jewish owned and operated. Also, most of them. I wouldn't give a dollar to a charity. I give a dollar to the white kid down the street. I wouldn't give a dollar to a charity. I mean, that the Jew's going to scrape about 90 cents off the top of it.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that's not the case with this. Well, whatever. I mean, it's done. I got something else for you, Bill. In the Book of Eli, it describes these giants and how tall they were. What is an L?
What is a what?
An L. E-L-L.
Beats me. I'm being honest with you.
Okay, yeah. It says these giants that they formed were like 4,500 L's or something. And I'm like wondering, well, how tall
is it? Well, okay. I mean, the standard unit of measure is the cubit. I could tell you what a cubit is, but I can't tell you what an L is. I'm sorry. I don't remember the word. I'm at a loss. Do you have a citation? And I'll pick Charles out of my book pile here.
Hold on. I can find it right here, but it'll take me a couple minutes.
I know I got Charles's Enoch down here somewhere, and I can't find that now.
The first chapter is when it describes how big these giants were. You know?
There it is. An L. Whoa, that's interesting.
Somebody told me it was the same thing as a cubit.
Well, that would be a foot and a half. Well, there were two cubits. There's the standard cubit and the royal cubit. The Greeks and the Egyptians had the same unit of measure. And it's generally the distance from the elbow to the little finger on most men. And if you go all the way to the end, that's a royal cubit, and that's about 21 inches. Well, I think that first I don't like to go there because I can't prove the archaeological provenance of the findings, but supposedly many giants have been dug out of the ground. But I don't like to go there. But the biblical description puts some of these giants at 7 to 8 feet tall. Oh, okay, or maybe 9 feet tall, and that's believable. But I know that some of the apocryphal books, I believe, are heavily embellished and make them like hundreds of feet tall. And that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But if you look like Aga Bashan in cubits, I think he comes out to be about 9 feet tall or something around there. And if you have a bunch of if the average height was 5'8" at the time, you could say that we were like grasshoppers compared to them. And that would be a metaphor or an idiom, and that would be a fair assessment. But if you go by some of the apocryphal literature, I think was embellished. I really believe that. And that's why it's apocryphal literature.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it doesn't represent what our ancient ancestors believed is true.
That's right. That's right. I mean, because that's the thought behind it, is that if this is an ancient book, and therefore, you know, if they thought this way, then who are we to question them?
Right. And there's, you know, I have like 5, 6, 7 very explicit verses in apocryphal literature that support two seed line, and I don't need them to prove two seed line, but it's basically represents what people believed about what the Bible story said. Even if you don't accept them as canon, they demonstrate what people believed that the Bible story taught.
All right. Okay, I found it. It's in section 2. Chapter 6, I believe, in section 2. Chapter 7. Verse 2. And they became pregnant and brought forth great giants whose stature was 3,000 ells.
Wow, what is, I want to see what, my point was to see what Charles said about the L as a unit of measure, because I'm sure it does not appear in Scripture.
No, I've never heard this word.
I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it appears in Scripture. E-L-L. No,
well, if a giant is described as 7 feet tall, which, you know, actually I don't really, you know what I mean, to me it would be a giant. Yeah, I know, even if it was an inch, according to Joe. 3,000 inches.
Yeah, even if it's a, it better be like a micrometer. It better be a millimeter.
I know, how could you say, I don't even know if they measured something that small. So none of us know what an L is, and nobody can find certainly. Let me do a Google search.
Charles's notes aren't telling me what an L is. Charms, plants, not trees. Charles's notes, I'm looking at his notes right now, are not telling me what an L is. No, my bed is a millimeter. They were 3 meters tall. That makes them about 8.5 feet. That's fine. No, I'm sorry, 9.5 feet. And that was a millimeter. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I hope people sense the sarcasm. That's all.
A millimeter.
Well, okay. Yeah, I mean, 3,000 millimeters would be 3 meters. the ancient Hebrews, Enoch invented the metric system. You see that? The French don't have anything after all. It's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, I got another question for you. How did you get this, in the part about Noah and Ham, does that thing against him after the flood. When I read my Bible, I don't get the part where he's actually meaning, what's meant by it is that he's sleeping with his mother-in-law.
Well, he slept with his mother.
Well, his mother, okay, his mother.
Well, okay, he who has uncovered his father's nakedness has slept with his father's wife. That's what the law says. That's in Leviticus. It's in Leviticus. You know, I really don't know anything about the Bible. It's in Leviticus 20:11 comes to mind. 20:11, and the man that lieth with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness. That's what it says. Leviticus 20:11.
Okay. May I read the passage?
Sure.
All right. That's This is, by the way, Jehovah's Witness Bible. It says, when Noah was planting grapes and he turned some into wine, he began drinking of the wine and became intoxicated, and so he uncovered himself in the midst of his tent. Later, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and went telling it to his two brothers outside. At that, Shem and Japheth took a mantle and put it upon their shoulder and walked in backwards. Thus they covered their father's nakedness, while their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, so you get this from that passage. They basically, he slept with his mother, then he bragged about it with his brothers.
Yep.
And they were shocked at it, and they
went and covered her up. Her nakedness is his nakedness. Read Leviticus 20:11.
Oh, no, that's fine. I totally understand that.
There's nothing wrong with two men seeing each other naked. I know whole generations of Baptists and I even know when Amish people that won't look on another naked man because they believe that was the sin of Genesis chapter 9. But why was Canaan cursed? Canaan was cursed, and Canaan was cursed as soon as it was pronounced. Ham's sin was pronounced. Canaan was cursed. Genesis chapter 9. But Mitzrayim wasn't cursed, and Cush wasn't cursed. Why weren't they cursed? Why weren't all of Ham's children cursed? Only Canaan was cursed.
Well, that makes sense. Now,
Canaan was the result of that union.
I didn't realize that. I never hear this from any of the churches or anything.
Well, of course you don't. They don't know what the hell they're reading when they read the Bible. They read John 3:16 and make up stories about everything else. I'm sorry. That's the way it is. So let the Bible, let the Bible, they always say that, the mainstream. Let the Bible define the Bible. Okay, you want to define Genesis 9? Go to Leviticus 20:11.
Well, it makes sense to me. I mean, it makes absolute sense. Figures out what was, what does this guy do that was so bad? Okay, so he saw his father naked and he joked about it.
Well, that wouldn't be a problem, would it? But if his father's nakedness is his father's wife, well, yeah, that's his father's nakedness.
Okay, let me ask. Now, I mean, we weren't there, obviously, so we don't know the story. But why would Shem and Japheth have to walk him backwards with a blanket?
They didn't want to see their naked mother laying there, just got violated.
Oh,
they were probably all drunk.
Okay, I'm just
they'd been boozing it up. I mean, Noah was blamed for it, but they were probably all drunk. I mean, Noah ain't going to get drunk on his own and Ham goes and does it. They were probably all drinking. And how many trailer parks does that same thing lead to? Drinking leads to that same thing in how many trailer parks in America?
Okay, now...
I mean, I know some places where people's family trees look like 2x4s. I'm kidding. But it's, you know, it's spoken about all the time.
Yeah, no, okay. But I don't know, it just seems like the prohibition with the Adam and Eve story is that the prohibition against taking a sister as a wife at that point from the beginning generation was okay. I can see that as being okay at that point.
Excuse, I'm sorry, hit me with this again.
No, from the beginning generation, from Adam and Eve, taking a wife from Adam and Eve. I mean, from the children of Adam and Eve, taking the children had to choose each other.
Your own sister, I don't know if that was forced or not. We're not revealed to that. And the only thing that makes sense to me, because I'm a rational sort of guy, I really am. And the only thing that makes sense to me is that Genesis 1, 26 through 28 describes a plural creation of our race. And Genesis 2 through, you know, through the end of chapter 4 describes in parables the creation and fall, that same creation and the fall of our race and the chief couple, the patriarchal couple are blamed for it, as they should be. And yes, they probably, I'm sure, it's literally true, while it's also a parable that's not actually giving us a historical play-by-play account. It's a parable that represents factual circumstances.
You know, Bill, I find this absolutely unbelievable when I came into this. And I was like, makes so much sense because, you know, I came into this with the 9/11 truth movement, and then it, you know, the Jew just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I'd learn all this history about them, and I was like, how come we don't know this stuff?
And right, and that's because mainstream Christianity is the best religion that Jewish money can buy, and it's going to be hidden from us. But there is, I mean, look at Mike with just a simple little book like Martin Luther's The Jews and Their Lies. He wrote this book 500 years ago.
Yeah, I read it. I have it.
Every Christian should read this by the fourth grade, and we don't. And he's the founder, and how many people, and Mike has the right idea. How many people out there that claim to be Lutherans, they have no clue what Martin Luther wrote. They have no clue about the foundings of their own church. That's crazy.
Yeah. I have to thank Mike Delaney for introducing me to you, because this is awesome. I mean, I have to hand it to him. He knows how to sift through the garbage.
Well, right. And a lot of people fault Mike for coming from here or coming from there, but I don't think I think he deserves credit, not fault, because we've all had a long trip to get to where we are. And some of us still have a long road in front of us.
I just find it so amazing. It's like I didn't really, after, you know, for many years, even recently, I said to myself, oh, this Bible, it's all a bunch of stories, fairy tales. Who can believe something like that?
Well, you know something, and it's easy to say that until you realize that this book and the observation of the world once your eyes are open are in total cohesion.
Exactly. That's the thing. The Jew is it. I mean, I was like, these people are exactly how it's described to the eye.
Well, right. It's the only thing that describes them. That's exactly. Yeah, you know, I told the story a few times, right? I was a history student when I was a kid. I loved history. And when I got older and started having babies, I forgot all about history. And I got into computers, and I was a self-taught computer programmer. And I was in law enforcement for 12 years, but I was also a self-taught computer programmer who had a you know, I was a manager of technology for a $50 million company before I went to prison, which resulted from the prior law enforcement career, right? Well, when I got to prison, I thought I'd win my appeals. It's my case was absolutely horrendous. It's a horror story in itself, but that's all right. I was naive enough to think that I would prevail in justice in my appeal, and that I would, you know, my game plan was to study mathematics because it would make me a better computer programmer because I only went to the 10th grade in school. I'm studying linear algebra for the first few months. And my appeals are looking worse and worse, and I'm getting knocked down for this and knocked down for that. I met somebody that had this book, The Unseen Hand, A. Ralph Epperson, Conspiratorial View of History. And I read this book, and I was dumbstruck by it. Because I knew most of the history, you know, most of the events, and his description of these events and the causes for them just struck me. I read that book twice my first year in prison.
Is that by General Cherub? Dovich?
No, it's A. Ralph Epperson. He's a professor of history in University of Arizona. He's no joke. I mean, he's mainstream.
You write that down.
And it's The Unseen Hand. It's a good first book to give to somebody that thinks that there's nothing wrong with the world. It's not an identity book. He doesn't name the Jew. He only names the Illuminati. And you know, it's like the book Alex Jones learned from, right? I don't know about that, but it's from that mold, that mindset. It's the international bankers and the Illuminati that he blames everything for, and the Masons. And he's right, but he doesn't name the Jew. But, I mean, the guy's a professor of history at the University of Arizona, and I don't think anybody in that position is going to name the Jew without being an awfully brave man. The only one I know is Kevin McDonald, right?
Oh, they hate him.
I think that book prepared me and my knowledge of history from my youth and reading that book prepared me for my next step on my little trip, what was going to Elkton and meeting a guy named Keith Holton that handed me a book called the Abrahamic Covenant, E. Raymond Katz. And I read that book and I had to get my hands on the Bible right away and read the whole thing. And I read that book and Verboten, and I read Covenant People. Keith had four or five books, and I read them all, and that was it. I was done. It was nothing but Bible and Greek and the classics from that point forward. And I had to – I was skeptical, and I had to prove this to myself.
Mm-hmm. You did a job. Bill, I'm amazingly impressed with all the work you've done. It's just, I would never do that. I guess there's some of us with more gifts. I mean, I love history.
Well, wow. You know, I had the advantage of having a lot of free time on my hands. Yeah,
right,
you know, that's the way it is. I had the time. I mean, I would never do it either if I was still caught up in the world trying to raise six kids, which is what I was doing, yeah, you know, and working two jobs a lot of times. And you can't do it. You can't do it and raise a family and have a career and study this. It's not possible.
Right.
You know, it's not – first, you're not – you have to step outside the box to look at it, to see that it needs to be studied to see that there's a problem. You have to be outside the box. Now, I was taken out of the box. I would have never stepped out of the box on my own. I was making $90,000 a year. I was 28 years old.
That's pretty good, Ben.
And that's no exaggeration. I would have never stepped out of the rat. I would have never stepped out of the rat race, and that's why I don't. You know, I don't blame a lot of people for not seeing this because they can't from where they are. They can't. I mean, it's just not possible. You're so caught up in your in Babylon. You're so caught up in a society that you don't want to open your eyes. I mean, you work all day and you come home at night and you deal with a wife and two dogs and four kids and paying bills and this and that. The system really has people entrapped. The system really has a lot of people entrapped. So it's very difficult. I mean, I admire the people that still are in the system that have jobs and wives and see this message. Those people, I believe, are blessed. I think that most people to see this message have to undergo a period of turmoil or a life-changing event. You know, they have to be hit on the head, in other words, to see this message. And I think that's true of most people. They're never going to see it from their, you know, two cars and a house and send the kids to college. And it worked for nothing but that mentality. Right, 32. In order to do what is right, you have to be pulled. You need a hook in the jaw. That's exactly how it works. And Yahweh's going to have you do it one way or another.
I mean, what opens people's eyes? I heard Jesus say that I want to come to the Father.
I'm sorry, I could hardly hear you.
I'm sorry. I heard Jesus say that. Now, I heard Jesus say that no one comes to the Father unless the Father calls him.
Well, right. And no one comes to the Father except through him, that's for sure. But right, you have to be, it's those whom he calls. I mean, people can go searching, and that's a noble thing, but it's, I mean, how many things are they going to search through, like you said, before they find the truth?
I mean, I'm 46 now, and my whole life I never found this. I mean, the story the witnesses told me when I got involved in it, when in my early 20s, or mid-20s, I was like, okay, makes sense. Sounds good, great, kingdom of God, everything, you know. But they started laying one burden upon you after another, and I never really made the plunge with them. Because they're just like the spiritual Israel people. They're just like, you know, it's open to everybody.
Well, right, and that's what they want. That's the perfect religion for the Jew world order, that it's open to everybody. They don't, you know, once the church becomes an organized corporation, what does it need to do? It needs to continually grow to feed the beast, to feed the greed at the top, to feed the power trip. That happened to the Catholic Church 1,500 years ago. But it never went outside of the bounds of European society until the Jesuits came along and got the idea that we should send missionaries into the jungles of Africa and convert those heathens and do this and that. And they really corrupted it. But it became a beast. It became a bureaucracy that needed to grow and accumulate power. And in order to grow and accumulate power, what do you have to do? You have to open the doors to everybody. It's about power and control and money. It's not about religion. It's not about truth. It's not about God.
You get people, I noticed, when they first get involved in these type of cults, I'll call them Bible cults, they have experienced this euphoria when they get involved in it, because I experienced the same. And, you know, they think they have, let's say, the spirit with them, but it's just an emotional thing, actually. I don't know if you've ever felt that way, knowing what I'm trying to describe here.
Yeah, but usually when I left the bar. Not when I went to church. I stopped going to church in about the seventh grade. When I realized that it was that something was wrong with it, and it wasn't for me, and never went back. I didn't know what it was, but it wasn't right.
Well, okay, well, Bill, how are people? You know, didn't Jesus say in Matthew 24 that this good news of the kingdom will be preached in all the inhabited earth, and then the end will come? Now, he may be talking about the Roman days back then, but doesn't it have like a dual fulfillment for our day?
Well, a lot of those prophecies have a dual fulfillment. I wouldn't want to generalize on all of them, because a lot of them had very specific fulfillments that are absolutely manifest. In other words, when Christ walks out of the temple and the apostles show him how magnificent the buildings of the temple are, and they point it out to them, and he says the day is coming when not one stone will be left upon another, right? And that's recorded in all three Gospels. It's in the end of Mark. It's in Luke. I think it's Luke 21. It might be Matthew 24, and it's in Mark maybe 12 or 13. I forget. Well, the apostles ask him three questions. They say, well, when will these things be? And what are the signs of the end? And what is the time of thy coming? They ask him three questions. And he gives them one answer. And it's up to us to sort out where he's talking about what. We're not told the answers to each question individually. He gives them one answer.
God, I really can't imagine being that person. I can't imagine it, what they must have went through. I mean, if he spoke with authority, and he, you know, from what I gather, these guys follow him to the end, you know. Beyond.
Right. Exactly. And he was able to do that because he's God come as a man. It's the profundity of the words of Christ that have never ceased to escape me. That they've always, every time I read them, it's absolutely striking.
Well, I am listening to a lot of your old audio files, older ones. The Two Seed Line, what I'm interested in right now. And, you know, these got a lot of them. I was like that. You know, I'm impressed with it. I put them on CDs and I listen to them in my truck.
Right, that's great. I'm happy with that. I'm humbled.
I can't get enough of it. It seems like I'd have to know more. It's like I have to know it. I've always been.
Well, you better buy some books, because I only got so much.
I know. It's you know, now there's plenty to read out there. I got a lot to learn.
Yeah, I always recommend that people read the scripture. I mean, every time I read a chapter, I see something different. I mean, that's the way it is. Yeah, you know, that's something. It's always something reinforcing. But you always see something different. You always see something that really escaped your notice before, or that you really didn't consider well enough before.
I have a question for you about God's commandment at the beginning. To Adam and Eve, to subdue the earth and have in subjection all the beasts and everything. He made that commission. Okay, to now, if the devil's children were already there, or were they? See, this is where I'm getting fuzzy on.
Well, I believe they were, and I believe that anthropology shows that. I mean, aside from the Bible, that they were allowed to eat from every tree in the garden except the tree that was in the midst of the garden. It was already there.
Right.
It had introduced itself into the garden. They were already there. You see, I believe that there was a noble race on this planet and that they screwed up and went astray and that they are the so-called fallen angels. And they polluted whatever was here.
Well, so it wasn't the sons of the heaven.
Well, yes, that they would be the sons of heaven, yes.
But that's actually you're talking about earthly beings, though, rather not spiritual beings.
Well, heaven is often a metaphor, not for something in space, but often a metaphor for the kingdom of God on earth or for anything that, you know, for the entity that's operating in accordance with his will. And because there was a rebellion from God, that Yahweh put our race here, and this must have been all planned in his foresight, in rebellion so that we would learn what rebellion from him was like. Because if we learn what rebellion from him is like and the horror that it could lead to in this temporal life, well, then in the coming permanent life, we're certainly not going to rebel from his word. Because we've tasted it. We've tasted good and evil. Mm-hmm. To know good and evil is to have the experience of both good and evil. Which that other race already had, those fallen angels that, however, those sons of heaven, they already had that knowledge of good and evil. They've already had the experience of it. Evil because they rebelled. They've experienced evil.
And the serpent, you think it was possibly a being, or a physical being? I mean, it had to be a physical being.
Well, yes, the serpent is that race of people. That race is the serpent, and any member of them. And it's used especially of the author of the rebellion. But any member of that race of rebels is the serpent.
Well, it would make sense to me if these were actually angels, and they did come to Earth and take human form, but their spirit of rebellion is within them, or their enmity with God is within them, and they would pass that on as genetic material to anything physical.
Well, their enmity of God, as soon as something is created out of its kind, it's enmity to God. As soon as you race mix, the product is odious to God. And it is an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
As soon as they mix their seed, that's their rebellion from God. Now, it says that there was war in heaven.
Revelation 12. Yeah.
Right. And that seems to mean space. And a lot of people would accept that interpretation. And I'm not going to argue with that interpretation. But what I'm going to say is that the words and the metaphors as they're used in the Bible do not really necessitate that interpretation. However, the ancients did interpret it that way. And Christ did use language that seems to express that meaning.
Right, when he cast the demons out into the pit.
I saw Satan fall from heaven, like lightning from heaven.
Right.
Now, whether or not he's using that metaphorically is another story. Now, to me, either way, it really doesn't matter. But I'm going to explain the possibility of both ways, because I'm not the one that's making the decision for you. I feel it's my duty to explain it both ways, that either option is a possibility. And you decide what to believe. I believe is my duty.
Now, when Jesus cast out the demons that this man had, what, like 2,000, they call legion. Now, that's the spirit beings. I mean, they obviously existed. So, I mean, if we were to believe this. Now, so why can't the angels at the beginning of the Bible, as described as sons of the heavens, you know?
Well, I believe, you know, if you read my paper, The Problem with Genesis 4:1, that there's a phrase, sons of God, in Genesis chapter 6 in the King James Version of the Bible and in the Masoretic text. And I insist and present an argument why that should be corrected to sons of heaven. And I use the Book of Enoch and the Alexandrian manuscripts of the Septuagint to support my argument.
Right. Makes sense to me.
And the fact that there would be no, if Adam's the son of God, there's no problem with the sons of God going into the daughters of Adam, which is what Genesis 6 is saying in the Masoretic text. So what's the problem? Yeah, you know what I mean? Yet evidently there was a problem, so that must mean sons of heaven. I believe that phrase represents that I know that the apocryphal writers saw them as angelic, beautiful beings and this and that, and that's fine. And I don't know if that's the way they envisioned them or not, or what they actually experienced. And either way you want to believe that, it doesn't matter to me. I'm only trying to present both possibilities as a plausible scenario, because we're not going to know the truth of all the matters until the end. We see through a glass darkly, as Paul says. So I don't like to lock myself into one position or another when I really don't know which position is the right position. So I'm open to discussing different plausible scenarios, yes, within the confines of Scripture. And Enoch, you know, somebody's asking me about flying saucers. I shouldn't use that terminology. Enoch, in 2 Enoch, he does describe being taken up in a vessel of light. And seeing other people like him. And that's unmistakable. It's not in 1 Enoch, it's in the Secrets of Enoch, this description.
So what does this mean, being taken by God? Enoch was taken. Does that mean he was just like dematerialized or something?
Well, yeah. Basically, it means that he was removed from Earth by God. That's the message that they're attempting to convey.
He became angelic.
Well, you might want to say that. I mean, that there's scriptural evidence that our bodies are going to be transformed into something other than what they are, that we function with here. Well, we can't imagine that the visible world is all there is to creation.
Right.
All matter is energy. I mean, I could talk about metaphysics all day. All matter is energy. And Paul says in Hebrews chapter 11, I mean, Paul's a physicist. He says that the things that are aren't made from things that are seen. The things that are visible are not made out of things that are visible. That's a highly metaphysical statement. And we know that all matter is energy, and that 90% of all matter is space, even though these things seem solid to us. I mean, electron microscopes don't lie. The technology is firm. I mean, a lot of our science is perverted by the Jew, but most of the technology is firm. It's the conclusions that are perverted by the Jew.
You know, Bill, the ring of truth this has to me, besides my knowledge of what the Jews have been doing, it's, you know, you see people like J.R.R. Tolkien and his books. He talks about how the races were created in his books. And it's, I mean, this is a fairy tale, of course, but it's like, hey, this guy was onto something. Because he describes all the different races on Middle Earth, and they were created. One's at odds with the others, you know.
Well, we don't have an answer for the other races of men.
Yeah, that's
the only answers are to me are in the New Testament. They're not in the Old Testament. Okay, I mean, Eli likes to argue all the time that bipeds or anthropoids or whatever you want me to call them, non-Adamic, man-like creatures, what were in the creation in Genesis chapter 6. But we don't have a firm indication of that from the scriptural account, whether Eli likes to argue it or not.
Right.
Okay, now what we have is we have a lot of races, we have some ape-like creatures that are a million years old, and we have a few species, solid species. I'm not talking about, you know, they find a kneecap and they extrapolate it into a whole culture, some of these damned evolutionists, okay? They'll find a kneecap and they'll invent the whole culture around it. And they'll have people in boats and trees, and it's crazy what they do. They just extrapolate things from the minutest finds. What we have a small handful of solid, definite races or species of hominids that are up maybe 100,000 years old. Neanderthal man. And that's all we have of Neanderthal man, basically. We don't have a whole lot. We have a few bone specimens here and a few bone specimens there. Now, okay, we have cave drawings in France that probably are 30,000 years old that we didn't do. The Cro-Magnons probably did, and we have Cro-Magnon findings. Okay, but we don't have a whole lot of substance in culture until about 30,000 years ago. And out of everything that we have the last 30,000 years, the white race is the newest race here, and that's undisputed. That's undisputed by scientists, except they would claim that we evolved. And I would just scoff at that because nothing's ever evolved. No, right. No life form has ever evolved from another life form, period. Now, I would think that those fallen angels are in a 30,000 year period. And that is when they went out and mixed their seed with every kind. Why we have so many diverse races of people, of hominids, appear between, I don't know, it might be 50,000 years and 10,000 years ago. And we're the last one. And we appear about 10,000 years ago, or maybe not quite. Maybe it is 7,500. I don't think we could get, even with the Septuagint dating, the Septuagint dating is much more accurate than that, than the Masoretic text, but I don't expect that to be perfect either. It's a hell of a lot more accurate historically than the King James dating, though.
So,
and that would date the rise of the white race about 7,500 years ago. And if it's 10,000, it doesn't burst my bubble. Because I know that the book isn't even in the form in the Septuagint. It's not perfect.
Okay, so when did the flood occur, according to you?
About 3245 BC. That is taking basically Bishop Usher's chronology and adjusting it for the errors between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. Because in the Masoretic text, it would be 2345 BC, and that's just impossible. But 3245 BC is very close to the era in which civilization, Western civilization, appeared in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, the Sumerians, right?
Right.
Now, is that that's near Babylon, or was that Babylon?
Well, Sumer is Babylon. I mean, Sumer is the wider land that Babylon is in, Babylonia.
Right.
And later it's called Chaldea, but its first name is among our people, is Sumer.
Right.
Sumer and Akkad, the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom.
So Nimrod was this fellow.
Yeah, Sumer is the lower part of the peninsula called Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, and Akkad is the upper part. Sumer and Akkad, the two oldest kingdoms of our culture.
Now, wasn't Nimrod a son of Canaan, son of Cain?
No, he was a son of Ham.
Oh, Ham. Oh, okay. This is after the flood.
Yes.
He's
the first tyrant. I mean, he's a Cushite. He's the first tyrant, basically.
Okay. Well, now, the Tower of Babel, the story about that. Now, God said that, you know, the people becoming one nation, or one people, and they can achieve just about anything now. So I'm going to confuse their languages and separate them. Why do that?
Why do that? Well, maybe to win over the grain.
I'm sorry?
Paul explains in Acts chapter 17 that Yahweh let every nation go their own way in order to see which of them would seek after him. It's a test. It's our race was put here to test us because he chastises his children. But through that, we grow strong. Through that, we learn. And the learning isn't retained in this world, but if there's no lesson, then the entire universe is for naught. If we don't take this lesson into the next life with us, then the entire civil existence is for nothing.
So you think this was some sort of just a test?
Yes, like absolutely. This is our training ground. This is our proving ground.
Well, I mean, confuse the language of these people in Sumer just to spread them out throughout the earth and see what happens.
That's what it's explained. We were told to fill the earth and to subdue it. And we're not gonna do that if we're all lumped together in the same area.
Well, yeah.
I think the whole thing is a parable representative of the fact that Yahweh wanted us to spread out and to fill the earth and not lump ourselves together in the same area where the entire group of us is easily corrupted. It's a treatise against cities. It's a parable against cities, basically.
Yeah, seeing what happens to our city today, I can see why
every city in history, every city in history has become morally debased. Part of our lesson. It's if he wants us to fill the earth, we're not going to do it if we're partying together in Mesopotamia. I think it's a parable that demonstrates that we did not want to, that we, even at that time, did not want to fulfill our mission. And that's part of the story of Genesis chapter 11. He told us to go forth and multiply and fill the earth with fruit. And we all wanted to stay in one place, nice and comfortable and party hardy.
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, I can see that. That's the description that the witnesses told me, that God wanted us to spread throughout the earth.
Well, that was the the commission in Genesis 1.
Right.
So we resist it right away. That's the lesson in that, I believe.
Oh, did you mention once, though, about the how does that race mixing leads to creation of evil spirits?
Well, yes, that's in Enoch. Enoch says this: evil spirits come from bastards.
Oh, okay.
You'll read it in Enoch. You keep reading Enoch; it's in there. I have the citation in my paper. The problem with Genesis 6:1-4. I just can't remember where everything is. I could barely remember where I am. No.
Right. Hey. Well. Okay. Now, Satan and the demons. They made a conscious choice to do this stuff before they race mixed.
Yes, they did, and that's the way Enoch describes it. It's a conscious choice, and that's the way, you know, Revelation chapter 12 represents it as a conscious choice.
So the goal was, I mean, did Satan, this angel, I mean, did he really think he was going to create someone, God was going to create something that could just, like, overpower him and overthrow him?
Well, you know something? It don't we all think that we could do better than God at times? Aren't we all tempted with that temptation?
Better than God?
Men have been tempted with that temptation since the dawn of time.
I mean,
we want to crossbreed these two tomatoes to make better tomatoes, right? And we want to crossbreed this wheat over here to make better wheat. And we'll have peace if we marry our daughter to the Chinaman next door, and he'll be good to us, and he'll grant us good things, right?
Better.
People have always thought they could do better than God. That they've always thought that there's a way to make the creation better.
Yeah, and isn't it something in Paul's epistles, Bill, how he always emphasizes that the fire, the baptism of Christ, of Yahweh, plunging into death on our part, that it's no longer him that lives, but the anointing that lives in him. It's a wonderful.
Well, right. That's called putting away the deeds of the flesh, to realize that we can't do better than God, that we have to depend on him.
Yeah. Well, the very center of our own self, you know, importance and vanity and stupidity, just to end it every day in our daily life. Yeah.
Well, I think that's symbolically what that rebellion was all about.
I can do better.
And
or
we
better.
Have free will. We have free will. And the bottom line is that even though we have free will, God, being God, can't help but know which route we're going to take. So he must have foreseen all this right from the beginning, and permitted it in order to teach us that lesson, rebel from him.
You know, Bill, that's interesting to say that, because I'm thinking about trying to get into God's mind. I mean, you know, it is like he knew that the rebellion was going to come eventually because it had to.
Absolutely.
And he says, in order for me to create beings of free will that would love me, I would have to allow them to do this rebellion.
Right, so that we learn what life is like in rebellion from God. And that way, We won't do it again. I mean, it ain't going to happen.
Nobody's
going to want to go through this again. I mean, life alienated from God. Nobody's going to want to go through that again.
True. Very true. Yeah, but people don't even know this stuff. I mean, they're too wrapped up in their own lives. They have to, you know, they don't know this stuff.
Me.
well, right, but the point is going to come in their lives or in their deaths. Well, when they've realized that they pursued all the wrong things and it was all for naught. And at that point, they'll know.
Huh. Well, you can't blame them. I mean, you don't want to create a robot.
We're warned. We're warned by Christ to store up treasure for yourself in heaven. But we don't read the word. So we work all our lives storing up treasure for ourselves on earth. And we die, and then our wife goes sleeping with some other guy, and he's driving the Cadillac we worked so hard to buy, and he's sleeping in the waterbed, and he's – that's the way it is, right?
You know, I don't know. I never got
that. Or your kids inherit the corporation you worked so hard to build, the company you worked so hard to build, and they go into debt with the Jews, and – the Jews end up owning your company, and your kids off jacking off your whole life's work on girls in Panama City, right? I mean, that's...
Well, that's because you didn't take the time off to train them well. Well, even if you did, it could do that.
Well, it happens to the best of us, and I brought up that example because that's what happened to Henry Ford. Yeah, you know, a man that knew all about the Jew, he was fully aware, he worked his ass off to build one of the best companies in the world, kept it debt-free throughout World War I and the Great Depression, and when he died, what did his sons do? They drove it straight to hell. So a man as brilliant as Henry Ford, who knew who the enemy was, who knew what time it was, and look at what happened to his company. So how could any of us build something temporal better than that? And think that our kids could keep it or that we're going to keep it. Pursue treasures, building yourself treasures in heaven.
Which means what to you?
Which means pursuing the word of God, loving your brethren, taking care of your kinsmen, taking care of your community, and the hell with worldly riches.
Right.
Love thy brother. Keep my commandments. That's it. It's simple.
So this, yeah, we all we know, I mean, through CI is that the other races. I mean, what do you think about black man who shows, you know, a lot of, let's say, devotion toward his faith. And
Well, first, I know for a fact, and I know from 25 years of experience with these people, that most of them are doing it out of pretense.
I was expecting you to say that. Thank you. So it's all pretense.
And I believe that they have this life, and that's all they have. And the same cause and effect laws that work for us in this life probably work for them. You reap what you sow.
Yeah, God makes it.
I mean, the natural law is the natural law. And I believe that reaping what you sow is part of the natural law. Most of the, you know, I mean, there's a lot of really, I've seen a lot of really devout appearing, or I should say apparently devout aliens in my life. And I've seen a great number of those apparently devout people in shower stalls with six legs in the same stall at 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I've seen some horrible things in my life, believe me. And
you know, Bill,
I'm just telling the truth.
Yeah, okay. You know, Bill, this is funny. I heard a story from one of the witnesses that I knew. She told me that that one of the congregation elders were all white spots. And I was like, what? And they were all ex, what is it they call it, disfellowship for that. But it's amazing to see that. I was like, what would get into your mind to do something like that? And several of them, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't think she was just, I mean, that's a serious accusation. People usually just don't throw it around. Oh, they're all wife swappers. I mean, a Jew might throw it around, but.
No, I mean, I'm not saying it's true or not, but you know, it's, somebody says it, you know, it is a serious accusation.
Well, I've seen hundreds of those apparently devout people with some pretty vile practices. And,
right.
And I've seen it up close and personal, and I don't want to see it again, believe me.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. When somebody says, oh, what about this person? He's such a good person. And it's like, yeah, you don't know the guy unless you actually live with him a few, at least for several months, you know?
Well, right. That's funny. I used to tell white guys that came into prison that if you're not a racist in 3 months, you're a fag. And 99% of the time, I was right. I swear.
That many of them took up the fudge packing job? That many of them?
Well, yes. That there were there was a pretty steady stream of vile beings.
Oh. I don't know what I'd do in that environment, though. I'd have to be put in solitary confinement. Because I killed the first guy who tried them.
Well, that's what it does. It tempers you. It tempers your patience.
In what way? What do you mean tempers? Like it steals.
Well, it sort of makes you understand that you really can't do anything about the evil in the world all on your own.
Right. Well, you know, all I can do is protect myself. And even then, I may not be able to.
Just don't be corrupt ourselves.
Yeah. My Firefox just crashed.
Hey, you know, the witnesses teach, you know, I'm always harping on that because that's where I'm coming from, you know, so, and now I don't agree with them at all, you know, it's been many years since I've been with them, but, you know, as far as the taking up of swords, they teach, you know, that Jesus only did that to display in the next few verses that, you know, he who takes the sword will perish by the sword. Now, what was the exact phrase of that that he said? I think it's in Matthew.
Well, he said two swords were sufficient. I think he was making a point that we have to defend ourselves. But, yet, you know, violence is not something a man should seek after, but it's something that a man should be ready to have at hand when he needs it. In other words, you have every right to defend yourself against the enemy.
Right.
But you have no right to go and seek out God's enemies on your own. We don't have a scriptural license to do that.
Right. Okay, now that I'll get to that point in a second. Now, in Matthew, I think it was in Matthew, he says, now, what was the phraseology? I'm sorry, I don't have the verse in front of me. Did he say, he who takes the sword will perish by the sword, or does he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword?
There's one verse that's poorly translated, and I don't want to fall into the trap of citing that verse.
Because in Luke, he says, let it go as far as this, according to Luke. But there's more detail in, let's say, one of the other...
Well, right. I think he's drawn the illustration that he had the option to fight his way out of it, but he knew it was written that he had to die. So
right.
Even though he had the option to fight his way out of it, he could not take that option.
Exactly. But there was what was the phrase you said about the message to the apostles was to he who takes the sword or he who liveth by the sword, or that's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, there's something in Revelation that's mistranslated, and I want to get my translation. Revelation 13:10 in the King James, it says that he that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity, and he that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. And that's
right.
Not what the Greek says. Okay, what the Greek says is, if one is for captivity, into captivity he goes. If one is to be slain by the sword, he is to be slain by the sword. In other words, it's teaching predestination.
Right, that's a totally different meaning.
Right, it is a tough, but the King James really dropped the ball on a translation.
Yeah. I think the Witness is also translated like that. I think they blew it. Let me see this.
In John 18:11, then Jesus said to Peter, put thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it? He knew that he had to die.
That's a given.
Now Luke 22, then he said to them, but now he that has a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, and he that has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. And to me, that's an indication that they were going to have to defend themselves.
Right, and the witnesses totally ignore that. I was like, wait a minute, if he tells them to go sell his garment, then there's no reason for him later on saying, I just wanted to do that just to say, you better not take up a weapon.
We turn the other cheek to each other. I know you're a good Christian man, and if you, if we have a heated exchange and you go a little too far, I shouldn't pummel the shit out of you for it. I should understand as a reasonable Christian man that you probably smacked me out of a fit of rage, and I should correct you, but I shouldn't just take a knife out and stab you to death because you got pissed off and punched me. That's we have to think rationally here, right? And that's turning the other cheek to a fellow believer and to a brother. But we don't have to turn the other cheek to the enemies of God. And Christ told the apostles here that basically they should be prepared to defend themselves because they were going to be attacked for the word. And that's the way I read that. And we have to defend ourselves against the enemies of God and against the ungodly. There ain't no Negro going to get away with hitting me, period. I'm going to beat him into the ground. But a white man might get away with hitting me.
That reminds me of, there was some movie that says, I only take that from some people and no niggers.
Well, right. And that's what, when your brother hits you, you should consider, you should stop and consider what happened for a minute before you act out of rage. And that's turning the other cheek with your brother, with your Christian brother. That's different. But mm-hmm. but if an alien hits me, it's on. It's on. I mean, he's... I went through 13 years of prison and not one alien lifted a hand to me, and I never lost a thing. That's you've got to defend yourself against the aliens.
Right, against the dogs.
And against the enemies of God. And I believe that's what he's talking here about the apostles. Yeah, you know, what he's making the analogy of when he sent them to spread the word. And he told them not to bring a purse and not to bring this and not to bring that. Well, now he's telling them that they better bring it. In other words, they better be prepared to defend themselves from his enemies, from the people that are going to be adversarial to the gospel. And violence to defend oneself is noble. You better defend yourself. But to seek out and destroy the enemies of God, we have no commission. We have no scriptural commission to do that.
Right.
There's a point in time where all of the enemies of God are going to be destroyed. But right now we have no commission to do that, and I could never put my imprimatur on that. I could never put my stamp of approval on that. It's wrong. And you're not going to win. You're never going to win. Who can fight with the beast? That's what the Revelation asks. Who can fight with it? We can't fight with the beast.
Hitler made a really good try.
Well, yeah, he did make a good try, but he's failed because that's what's written. And if Adolf Hitler, with the might of the most powerful nation on earth, you know, as far as maybe not in sheer numbers, but in as far as the intelligence and the unity of a people, Germany in World War II was definitely the most powerful nation on the earth.
Oh yeah. They were the best armed.
Oh, okay, they were the best armed, that they were the most motivated, that they were the most unified, that they were the most
moral,
homogenous, which leads to the strength of a nation. They were the most moral. They had everything going for them, and the only thing that could beat them was the whole damned world, and that's what it took. And Satan gathered the whole world against Germany, and we were the whores for the Jews that went right along with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it took to defeat Germany, and if Adolf Hitler couldn't do it with the entire nation behind him, then we sure as hell should just wait for God himself.
Well, you know. Do you think he lost that war by, I mean, he did not start that war. It was, but he did start the war preemptively, I should say, with the Soviet Union.
Well, yes, he did, but he had to because Stalin was about to roll his tanks into Western Europe.
Yeah, I've heard about that. That was going to happen. Eventually, they were going to go to war with each other.
Oh, they were getting ready. Stalin was building up for it. He was getting ready, and Hitler knew it. So Hitler cut him off at the pass. He jumped the gun and really surprised the Russians, and they weren't prepared for it. That's why Hitler did so well. I mean, he was outnumbered 100-1 in the long run.
I remember
and he would have won anyway if we didn't supply. Yeah, you know, if we didn't join the war and supply the Russians with all the trucks and armaments they needed.
Yeah. Well, it was the factories in the 1930s, according to Captain Ramsey, that they built beyond the Ural. All that capital. I mean, yeah, I was wondering. I said, wait a minute, this is the Soviet Union, right? It's a communist country. How could they build 34,000 T-34s.
Well, they didn't. We did.
Exactly. And I'm like, what? Yeah. And that was just one type of tank. They had several that, you know, they produced many. Anyway. But I remember when they first invaded, they, what was it, the Western Military District, he was executed by Stalin for losing almost his entire command, like, you know, several armies.
Yeah, Hitler had some traitors too in his among his generals, which definitely didn't help the cause. Some of his own generals were working against him.
Okay, Bill. Getting back to the Bible, it says here in the verse, was it Matthew 26:52? Or, yeah, 52. Return your sword to its place, for all those who take the sword will perish by the sword. Now, do you consider that a proper translation?
I want to say yes, but I have to look at my translation, but I'm sure it is. I'm scrolling to it now.
Because that would seem to mean that you better not take that sword.
Well, right, but taking the sword is not defending yourself.
Right, exactly.
Taking the sword means to be the aggressor.
Thank you. See, they teach it just the opposite. They teach it.
Well, that's wrong, because taking the sword is to be the aggressor. You just don't want to be the aggressor. There's no reason to be the aggressor. Return your sword unto his place, for all those taking the sword shall be destroyed by the sword. Well, we have no commission to be the aggressor. We have no commission. Our fathers disdained the law of Yahweh. So we lost our right to judge by his law. And that's why Christians will not be judged by the law. And we've lost our right to do it. And we're told that, basically, in Scripture. We're told not to condemn the sinners, but put them out of our company. That's the Christian commission.
So if you're living in a hostile nation, which we are living in one, by the way.
Well, we have to separate ourselves from the sin. And we have to speak out against it. But we're not to carry out the judgments of the law.
Right. I mean, but to separate yourself, I mean, what could that mean in practical terms?
Well, it means don't go to that bar. You know, six fags hang out in there, and you're going to be just stay away from those people. Stay away from. Don't accept that the I mean, I have family members that have strange proclivities that I don't even talk to. I've separated myself from them. I don't want to talk to them, and they've been informed that I'm not going to talk to them. And that's just the way it is. And I'm sure not going to commune with a stranger that by stranger, I mean a white person who's not a family member who has strange proclivities. That I'm not going to have anything to do with those people. And if I have to, I'm going to tell them right, very bluntly, you're a homosexual, you're a sexual deviant, and I have no company for you. That's the way it is. And that's my duty as a Christian.
Yeah, I always felt hostile towards homosexuals.
Well, we're right. And I use them as an example because they're the easiest example. But the same would be true of anybody who violates and flaunts God's law. Any one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or a drunkard or a drug abuser. That's the way it is, and that's our duty, to separate ourselves from those people and not to support the beast. And we all have to deal with the beast to an extent. So we take what we need and not what we want. Do you understand the difference?
Oh.
I mean, you might be able to afford that $40,000 car that looks really cool if you take a bank loan, right? Well, taking that bank loan, you're really supporting the enemy. Well, what you do is you buy the $12,000 car you got the cash for, and you tell the Jew to stick the bank loan in his rear end, right? not, don't go into debt. Don't support Hollywood. Don't support Motown, Nashville. Everywhere that the enemy makes money from us and uses that money to destroy us, and that's what they do with it.
Right, right.
Don't feed the beast, in other words. And that's all Christians can do today is try to separate themselves from the sin and the sinners.
Yeah. You know, I actually have to work in many places where there are minorities, and I go right to the synagogues and jobs as well.
Well, charge them double if you have to. I mean, they would
no,
do it to you.
I can't do that, but I work for a company that sends me to these places.
I got an ad on my website. Yeah, you know, I got a business, and I'll do a website for $150. If a lawyer called me, I'd tell him right away it's $1,500. And I want half the money up front. I ain't going to pull any bones. I'm being dead honest. If a Jew calls, I'm going to tell him right away, $1,500, and I want it up front.
Well, so when Jesus said, you know, don't, what is it, what did he say about don't spread the gospel to dogs? Or don't cast your pearls before swine.
Well, right. That means don't give the other races anything. Don't. There's no reason to preach Christ to them. Paul said that it's folly to preach the gospel to those who are going to die. That they if they don't have the spirit of Adam, they don't have an expectation of life beyond this one. And you know, there's no reason to hate those people, except for their actions, right? I mean, we might hate them for the way they act. There's no reason to hate those people, but we don't preach to them the gospel of salvation because they don't have that salvation coming. That's just the way it is. So you don't throw your pearls before swine. There's no reason to be trying to convert Negroes to Christianity because they can't possibly be Christians. And they, whenever they become Christians, they become very bad Christians. Well, what do you get? You get Jeremiah Wright. That's what you end up with. Now you got militant Negroes as Christians claiming to be Christians. That's we don't need any more Jeremiah Wrights. And that's the result of our race throwing our pearls before swine. That's what we end up with.
Otherwise, what they do is they become identists and turn and rend you. Right?
Yeah, right.
Well, Bill, let me ask you. I mean, we know what dog.
Yeah, Pastor Manning's a dog, too. He's just trying to incite whites to do things that they shouldn't do. That's all he's trying to do. He's a troll. He's a troll. I'm sorry, John.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't trust any of them, to tell you the truth. I don't want any of them.
No, you should never trust any of them. Even when he said, yeah, you know, Pastor Manning, you know, a lot of identity people get excited about this Negro that's telling the truth about one Negro, right?
Yeah.
He's still evil. He still thinks he's a Christian, and he's basically I don't even want to go into it, what he is.
Well, now it also says, "Don't cast your pearls before swine." Now, there's a difference there between a dog.
Well, I think they're both metaphors that mean the same thing.
Well, could the swine be, let's say, a fellow white who is, you know, a degenerate?
Well, you know, you should try to admonish a fellow white who's a degenerate. And tell him that he's screwing up and that there's a better life on the other side of morality. And then if he doesn't accept your admonishment, he should be treated just like those Negroes. He's no better. And there's other scriptures that could be pointed to that say that same thing in a different way. Paul says that the unrepentant are basically in the same boat that the godless are in.
The what are in?
The godless.
Godless?
The godless. Only one race has a god.
Right.
The godless aren't the people that reject God. They're the people that didn't have him in the first place.
Hey, I'm over here at Jeremiah 31, verse 28, and you quoted this the other day.
Yeah, I quote it all the time. It's also the centerpiece of my immigration problem and biblical prophecy essay.
Ah, I didn't get to that yet. Oh, no, actually, I did read it all. That's where I got it from.
Well, that's exactly what's going on in the world right now. That's the point we're at in Jeremiah's prophecy right now. And it's been going on. I mean, it's really gotten to a crescendo these last few years, but it's been going on for a while.
Right.
It's been going on for 50 years. It's just a slow, slippery slope. And that's just before I think that Jeremiah 31:31 is talking about the new covenant, of course, but it's talking about the culmination of the new covenant, which doesn't happen until the return of Christ.
Let me quote this, see if it sounds right to you, Bill. I mean, because it sounds different from the way you describe it. It says, in verse 29, in those days they will no more say the fathers were the ones that ate the unripe grape, but it was the teeth of the sons that got set on edge.
The unripe grape? Well, that's an odd translation.
I know.
The sour grape.
Yeah, I know.
Not all sour grapes are sour because they're unripe.
I know, it doesn't sound right.
Well, if you want to understand what the sour grapes are, you have to go to Deuteronomy 32:32. For their vine is the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. And what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah? Sodomy and fornication, race mixing, and homosexuality. That's what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. That's why Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. So the seed of man and the seed of beast and the sour grapes, the sour grapes must be the acceptance and promotion of race mixing. Only thing that makes sense. That's exactly what's going on in every white nation right now.
Yeah, I've known it. I've known people doing that.
It's a test from God, and it's a result of our punishment. It's also in the blessings of obedience and the cursing, the curses of disobedience. It's a result of our disobedience,
yeah,
our departing from the true religion, our acceptance of the Jews. We accepted the Jews as a people into our society, the enemies of God that John tells us not even to speak to, and we accepted them. We believed the lies of our ministers, whom the Jews bought, so that they could subvert Christendom and destroy it. That's the only reason why they came into our society. That's been their plan for 5,000 years, and we've accepted them, and this is the result. This is the punishment.
Yeah, I see it. I see it all now.
Even a lot of those so-called ministers themselves are Jews, a lot of them.
Oh, right, that's true. Benny Hinn.
Even in denominational, whatever, mainstream, all over.
Mainstream Christianity is the best religion that Samuel Untermeyer and Jacob Schiff could buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
They buy it, they did.
No, but Bill, let me ask you this. Why is it so hard for people to understand that these damned other races are not good for us? I mean, I didn't see it. I said, oh, we're all, you know, they're all just different people from different cultures.
Well, right, but if you want to know the quality of the people, let's do what Martin Luther King Jr. said. Let's judge them by their character. Go look at the crime statistics. I judge them by their character all the time.
And then they'll throw
and they're no damn good. Look at their cities. Look at their nations that they left to come here, whether they were pulled, sold out of them or not, or left voluntarily. Look at Africa. And wherever you bring Africans, you end up with Africa. You want the proof? Look at Detroit. There ain't no difference between Detroit and Sudan.
It's Mogadishu.
There's no difference. Right. Detroit, Mogadishu, Zimbabwe, it don't matter. There's no difference. You want Africans, wherever you bring them, you're going to end up with Africa. You want Chinese, wherever you're going to bring them, you're going to end up with China. Go to Chinatown in New York City. You've been there. It's a sewer.
Yeah, it is.
It's a huge, stinking, oozing cesspool. They fill their basements with water in the filthy city with the sewage, and they grow their vegetables that they sell to Chinese restaurants. Weeks and water chestnuts and everything.
They grow that in their basement in the sewer?
Well, I've heard the stories and I believe them.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Well, you know, they catch roadkill. Some of them catch roadkill and they'll serve it up in a Chinese restaurant.
No doubt. I mean, they eat anything. I've observed them up close and personal. They eat anything that moves. They'll eat you if you stand still too long. You'll be right in that wok.
You know, I was just in Chinatown the other day near Spring Street. Oh, man. I was like, and I'm thinking, I'm looking at these people. I'm like, you know, these people are really soulless. You know, I just don't see any empathy in them, you know.
They had no empathy. Every Negro I ever knew, when he was remorseful, he was only remorseful for getting caught. He was never, ever remorseful of the act. They only feel bad that they get caught. Period.
Okay. Right. Let's take MLK. Or Michael, whatever the hell his name is. When did that man ever show any sort of contrition?
He was a trained communist, and he was trained by the Jews. He knew exactly what he was told to do.
Exactly.
I'm sure some Jew wrote that damn speech. He didn't write that speech. Some kike from Hollywood wrote that damn speech.
Yeah.
I have a dream. I have a dream, too. It don't include him.
Guess what? You're not in it.
I think the Jetsons is probably the best thing that came out of the 60s. It's absolutely prophetic.
The Jetsons?
The Jetsons.
The cartoon?
Yeah.
Well, what's so prophetic about it?
There aren't any niggers in heaven.
Man.
No, I dream of genie. Gilligan's Island.
Oh, please.
Oh, they had some monkeys on the island one time.
All right, well.
The millionaire guy, he should have been a Jew.
No, they wouldn't be able to hide that then.
I have a sister that when we teased her interminably when we were kids because she insisted on on watching Gilligan's Island every day. And every damn day she'd wonder if they were going to get saved in the end. I swear. She thought that was the day. I swear, for years. We still tease her about it. I mean, she's not, I don't know, she's about as bright as a 20-watt bulb that died 3 years ago. My sister, I love her, but she's, she didn't get any of the protein at the dinner table, I don't think. Well, okay. I mean, I guess I'll wrap this up. 3 hours is 3.5 hours is long enough, maybe.
All right. Yahweh bless you, Bill and John, and all you folks. Love
Yahweh. And thanks, and praise Yahweh, and I'll see you here next Monday. And tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, Crystal Leo's Fellowship Call.
All right. God bless you.
Thank you. Praise Yahweh.